Good morning. We are going to start. I'm calling to order this meeting of the House Committee on Children, Families, Finance, and Policy. Welcome to all. I know we've got a couple folks running a little bit late, but we're going to start, as usual, by having the clerk take the roll for those of us who are here.
Chair Binto?
Present.
Vice Chair Keeler?
Present.
Representative Daniels? Representative Bliss? Representative Coulter?
Present.
Representative Davis?
Present.
Representative Hansen? Representative Hemmingson-Yeager?
Present.
Representative Hicks?
Present.
Representative Hudson? Representative Katizawatun? Representative Lee? Representative Nelson?
Present.
Representative Pettis-Vega?
Present.
Representative Zalesnikar?
We do have a quorum. I should note Representative Daniels, I know, is out, is excused. I think a number of those other folks are just running late, so I'm sure they'll be joining us very shortly. We've got our minutes, as usual. I'll ask Vice Chair Keeler if you would mind to move approval of our minutes on March 8th, 2025.
Yes, Mr. Chair. There are two changes that we will need to make. We need to add Representative Hudson onto the members present, and then there's just an adjustment on the second page. Moving me from representative to vice chair Keeler.
Excellent.
But with those changes, I move the approval of the March 8th minutes.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Any other additions or corrections to those members? So hearing none, all in favor of approval of the March 8th minutes with the two corrections that Vice Chair Keeler made, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Any opposed? Okay. The motion passes. Those minutes are approved. Thanks so much. Members, we have four bills up today. We're going to start with Representative Hill's bill. We're going to change the order just slightly and have House File 2478 begin. And so, and Vice Chair Keeler, if you wouldn't mind moving approval of House File 2478 to bring that before the committee.
So moved.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. And so, Representative Hill, welcome to the committee, and please begin presenting your bill. And I'd invite your testifiers to feel free to make their way up to the front as well and join you.
Yeah.
And you can start as they do that, Representative Hill.
We'll start with one, and we'll have another join us here in a minute. Thank you, Chair Pinto and members of the committee. Today, I bring before you Bill House File 2478, and this is an appropriation for Way to Grow. Way to Grow is a nonprofit organization that has operated for more than 30 years, supporting families with children from birth through age 8 here in the Twin Cities. And Way to Grow works with more than 1,800 individuals in the Twin Cities area and surrounding suburbs. And it provides year-round services every day to families and their communities. High-quality early childhood care and education remain elusive for many of our low-income families here in the cities. And the pandemic has exacerbated existing challenges and resulted in increased learning losses for our most precious resource, natural resource, our youngest learners. We have an opportunity to improve access to early childhood care and education for an increased number of low-income BIPOC families. Children who participate in high-quality programs during their early years have been found to experience positive long-term outcomes, such as higher rates of education completion, lower criminal justice system involvement, and lower rates of substance abuse. Studies show that a child's early years, right up through third grade, age 8, are critical in developing the physical, cognitive, social, and emotional skills that will make them more likely to succeed in school and go on to succeed in life. According to a report in MinnPost in 2021, Minnesota ranks 4th out of 51 for the most expensive child care in our country. Meanwhile, many child care programs and centers operate on razor-thin margins, and our public school districts are not able to offer enough pre-K spots to fill this need. Way to Grow fills this need through its evidence-based early childhood and elementary education home visiting program that focuses on educating both parents and children, and it equips the parents to be their child's number one teacher, exactly what we need. This model is designed to equip traditionally disinvested communities to achieve transformational outcomes. Investing in Way to Grow is great by 8 early programming will help families build a strong foundation early, and will help to close the education gap before it even begins. This, of course, would result in higher lifetime outcomes and generational shifts that lift families out of poverty. And with that, I'm excited to turn it over to Carolyn Smallwood, who serves as the CEO for Way to Grow.
Thank you.
You're welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Carol Smallwood. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Carolyn Smallwood. I am the CEO of Way to Grow. Over the last 3 decades, Way to Grow has been about the business of closing the achievement gap with our families. Thus far, we've been able to serve 11 different counties. To date, we are a very metric-driven organization that provide intensive one-on-one free home visiting services to over 1,800 people in the Minneapolis, Brooklyn Park area, and the 6 surrounding suburbs. We're proud of the work that we do. We're very metric-driven, meaning that we have proof that if we start early with children, children are going to succeed by the third grade. We provide services to families prenatal to age 8, grade 3, following our children into about 35 Minneapolis public schools and 26 charter schools. The services we provide is intensive. Health education, early education, and elementary education. Our family educators provide one-on-one services with our parents. We believe that the parent is the primary educator of the child, okay? Imagine going into the home with books, curriculum, parents' teachers' curriculum, science, math, and working one-on-one with the parent, one-on-one with the parent, the entire family. Imagine that, okay? A lot of our families do not have the resources. Way to Grow with funders' support, the city support, and the county support, we've been able to provide over 11,300 home visits, okay? What's fantastic, though, is that we know what works, okay? We know what works. Over the last several years, our children, over 80% of our kids were being ready for school. Last year, we had an all-time high of 98% of our kids being ready for school, compared to the state average of 60% of all students in the state when it comes to early education. However, if you dig down with those numbers, if you go into low-income families or low-income children, it's only 35 to 40% of our kids are being ready for school. We're in a crisis, but what's positive, we have a tool that works. So that's why we want to expand our services. 81% of our parents attended a parent teachers conference. Okay? So we work with parents one-on-one to ensure that their kids are attending school. Right? 89% of our babies were born at a healthy birth rate. And you know how important that is as well. So we have the numbers that work. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And there's a second testifier as well. Make your way to the front if you can, please.
Up next, we have Ms. Sydney Bean, who is a parent in the program. So please come on down.
This is one of our wonderful parents that's been with us for the last 7 years.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. And please identify yourself to the next testifier and then proceed.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Sydney Bean.
Okay, please. Feel free to dive on in.
Oh.
Yeah.
Am I just starting with?
You're starting with, yeah. You go ahead and start.
Go for it.
Okay.
And we've got just like about a minute or two left in the time. Just to say.
Okay. Well, I'm a mom of 5, and all of my kids have gone through Way to Grow from prenatal on. Our family educator is Allison Dakota, and she has been fantastic providing social, emotional support to my partner and I, and then to our children as well. And she brings in books every time we have a visit. The home visits are especially important. I actually have generalized anxiety. And so having someone come into our home has been very beneficial for myself as well as my whole family. And then Allison has helped us with how to read to our kids and having fun in learning. And I think that's one of the most important things, is that it's fun. And then it's a big celebration when the kids graduate from pre-K.
Great. Thank you so much. And thanks for sharing your experience. Really, mm-hmm. really appreciate it. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are there any other members of the public wish to testify on the bill?
Okay.
That first. Thank you so much. And then we'll move to member questions and discussion. Member questions or comments about the bill. Vice Chair Keeler, please.
Thank you, Representative Hill. I just have some questions about the home visiting program. Is that how often do you go out and visit? Is there, we also have individuals who are very transient because of homelessness. How do you make sure that you're still helping them? Maybe they don't have a home to go do home visits for?
Yeah. Ms. Smallwood or Representative Hill?
Wonderful. Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you for the question, Vice Chair. A couple of things. The pandemic really allowed Way to Grow to expand the ways that they meet the needs of families and students in particular. But I do think it's probably best to turn it over to Ms. Smallwood.
Ms. Smallwood.
Thank you, Mrs. Chair and members. Our families receive between 3 to 4 home visits a month, depending on how old the children are.
Okay. Okay. Vice Chair Keeler, all done. Okay. Other member questions or comments? Maybe I'll just ask, Ms. Smallwood, can you let us know how the program is funded currently?
Our program is funded by our foundations, individual donors. We receive funding from City of Minneapolis, as well as Hennepin County, and we receive funds from the Minnesota Department of Health as well.
And then also, about how many more families would you expect could be served with the appropriation being proposed here, the $300,000 per year?
About 150 families.
Okay, and sorry if you said that before.
No, I didn't.
Okay, so any other questions or it was Lesnikar, Representative. Pardon me.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you. My question is, when I look at the can you explain to me what your current operation revenue is compared to your expenses? I mean, what is your bottom line right now as far as the, I just want to know how that compares to what this ask is.
Oh, okay. Our current budget is about $4 million.
Yeah, and, okay. Representative Lesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. So what are your current expenses?
Our current expenses.
Yep. We go through the chair, so the chair.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. No problem. You identified. Go for it.
Okay. Can I go for it?
You're all good.
Okay, I'll look
Dive
for
on in.
You. I'm sorry. Our current expenses run around about $3.2 million.
Okay. Representative Lesnikar.
Thank you, Chair. So you're operating right now at a profit.
Ms. Smallwood.
Yes.
Representative Lesnikar.
So, Chair Pinto, so my question is, we have at this committee so many programs to be looking at. I guess I just wanted to know, if you're operating at a profit, why the $600,000 ask to this committee?
Let's direct that to the testifier. Ms. Smallwood?
Can I answer?
Please, yeah.
The reason why $600,000 is primarily in order for us to expand services in other geographical areas. It costs us about $3,500 per family, right? It appears that we're operating at a temporary profit, primarily because we're building our organization in other geographical areas. On average, we're running our expenses are running about $3.8 million. Per year. So we've had a campaign that has provided the surplus, and we're beginning to spend those dollars down because we're expanding into other areas. We have a goal to serve up to 300 to 400 more families within the next 2 to 3 years.
Representative Lesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. No further questions. Thanks.
Okay. Representative Davis.
I just have one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're expanding it to a few hundred more families. And are those again, is that being expanded just within the area that you're currently reaching, or are you reaching out to greater Minnesota?
Ms. Smallwood.
Currently, we're operating in 11 different counties, and as we move forward, we definitely would entertain the idea of moving across the state wider if we receive the funding. And this is a gradual process for us.
Could you give us a sense of the scope of those counties, Ms. Smallwood? You mentioned Minneapolis, Brooklyn Park, I believe, so that'd be Hennepin County, but then the other 10 counties, just give us a sense as to where they are.
Yeah, we have Hennepin County, Dakota County, Washburn. We out east in St. Paul, some areas in that area as well, Carver County.
Okay.
Yep. And we've been able to do that basically through our virtual home visit as a result of the pandemic.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Representative Davis. Okay. So I think we are all set, and Lee Daniels not being here, I'm not going to, won't call on him, but we'll give Representative Hill the last word on his bill.
Wonderful. Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you, members. Again, I just want to highlight the value of programming like Way to Grow. And the evidence has pointed us in the direction to prove that this investment is going to benefit our communities to well over $9 of impact. So every dollar will generate $9 plus of impact. They'll serve our communities and help our young people enter into life with the best possible opportunities to grow, develop, and be important and integral parts of our communities. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Hill. And Ms. Mullen, thanks so much for your important work. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
With that, the chair lays over House File 2478 for possible inclusion in the committee's budget bill. Thank you. And we're going to move, I think. Okay, so. We're going to, Representative Hill, I think we're waiting for something on your second bill, and so we're going to have you wait a little bit if that's okay.
We do have
it. Okay, actually, you know what, Representative Hill, I guess it sounds like we have what we needed for your bill after all. So,
all right.
Yeah, why don't you stay on up there then, and we will get to your second bill as well then. So this is House File 2281, and I think I'll ask Vice Chair Keeler if she can to move House File 2281 to bring that before the committee.
I move House File 2281 before us, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. And then, Representative Hill, you do have an author's amendment, the A1. Is that correct, Representative Hill? You want us to move that?
Yes, that would be the motion.
Okay. Looks like just a technical, just a tweak. And Vice Chair Keeler, you're willing to move the A1 amendment?
I move the A1 amendment.
Okay. Members, any discussion to the A1? So hearing none, all in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. So the bill is amended in the way you wish, Representative Hill, and please proceed with presenting your bill.
Wonderful. Thank you. Very briefly, thank you, Chair Pinto and members of the committee. Very briefly, I want to move and walk through House File 2281, which addresses early learning licensure and the ability for those who serve in these roles to join their local bargaining units. Section 1 of this bill requires licensure for all of our early learning programs and their practitioners. And currently in Minnesota, we have a number of school-based early learning programs that do require licensure. And these include School Readiness Plus, also early childhood family education programs. Other programs, however, do not require this licensure, and those include voluntary pre-K, and also some school readiness programs. This became more urgently needed after a law passed in 2017 included language that created a voluntary pre-kindergarten program without licensure requirements. Now, many districts do post jobs that have, quote, a highly desired qualification attached. But since it's not a requirement in statute or the district, the position is not eligible to join the local existing bargaining unit. This does a few things, but it goes on to harm the teachers in the program as they are vulnerable and can often be paid much less than other licensed teachers. And it also has the potential of interfering with the age-appropriate delivery of instruction, especially if the teacher does not have the proper training in brain development and play-based learning that's appropriate for children of this age. Section 2 of this bill allows these teachers to be members of their local teachers' bargaining unit. And it is regardless of their licensure. And it allows for units that have been organized by unions that are currently existing for those individuals to remain with those unions. For example, SEIU Local 284 has organized the early childhood and early learning programs in Hopkins, and this language would allow for them to stay with their union. Section 2 also in House File, Section 2 is also found in House File 1690 and 1691. And these bills have been heard in the House Education Policy, State Government, Judiciary, and Labor Committees. Section 2 is also included in Chair Pryor's Education Omnibus Bill. Again, here's the current reality. Most voluntary pre-kindergarten teachers are licensed, but with openings and postings that say they prefer a licensed educator, rarely hire someone without a license. And so that's not the issue. The issue is that this technicality allows for these teachers to remain vulnerable. It allows our youngest learners to be in a situation where they may be served with someone that does not have the proper preparation and training. So with that, we have a few folks that have signed up to testify, and I'd like to turn it over to them.
That sounds good. Let's have those folks. And so I'm going to call up Sarah Craig first. I'll have you come up first, and we're going to change the order just slightly. And then once you get settled in, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony. Welcome.
Hi, I'm Sarah Craig.
Yeah, please proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Pinto and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Craig, and I've been a proud teacher in my district for more than 10 years. I hold a Minnesota state license in pre-primary education as well as elementary education. I hold a master's degree from St. Catherine University. I could write a book about the importance and value of early education. I'm guessing if you're part of this committee that you know the enormous impact of early education and early intervention on children. Preschool children deserve professional, licensed teachers. We work in tandem every day with other professional service providers, such as licensed school nurses, occupational therapists, psychologists, etc. We are required to be individual education plan team members for all of our students who receive special services. One third of the students in our preschool classrooms are on IEPs. Preschool children deserve teachers who have a high level of knowledge and understand the complexities of the developmental continuum. Three times a year, we rate our students on over 50 objectives based on MDE's early childhood progress indicators of progress. With this information, we work to individualize each child's learning path so that no matter where they start, they're moving forward in all areas of development. Until recently, all teachers in South Washington County schools were required to be licensed, from our ECFE teachers who work with infants and parents to our adult basic education teachers. This changed in 2018 when our school board, under the recommendation of our then superintendent, voted to no longer require state licensure for teachers in our preschool program. This decision de facto expunged 23 teachers out of a contract and out of the district's teacher union. Previously, preschool teachers had been in the same salary scale, had worked for tenure status, and had the same responsibilities, rights, and benefits as our colleagues. Since this vote, many preschool teachers found other positions either in K-12 or outside of our district. Our youngest learners deserve teachers who are licensed and meeting their needs. This loophole needs to be closed now so that preschool children can benefit from the best teachers that our state has to offer. So why is this necessary? South Washington went as far as saying we could no longer call ourselves teachers. They were stripping that title from us so we couldn't form our own union. Well, we fought that and we did end up forming our own union. So why is this necessary if we formed our own union? Our early learning unit is small and does not have the same power in numbers as we would as part of the main teacher union. This has created a two-tier system for those who were hired before 2020 and lower salary for those hired after that date. As far as I am aware, all of my preschool colleagues hold a license, yet the district uses the statute to treat us differently. My question is this the kind of employment environment we want to have in schools in the state of Minnesota? Do we want teachers of some of our youngest students who are in a crucial stage of development to have to fight to show their worth despite being fully licensed and with post-baccalaureate degrees? Changing this law is the best way to get preschool children the educational experiences that they deserve. Thank you.
Thank you so much, and thanks for your work. Thanks for being with us. I'm going to call up Dominic Kirkpatrick, please, as the next testifier. Okay. Hi, and please identify yourself. Are you Dominic Kirkpatrick?
I am.
Okay, good. Well, welcome. It's so glad to have you, and please proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Pinto and committee members. My name is Dominic Kirkpatrick. I'm a teacher on special assignment, currently serving as president of both the Eden Prairie Education Association and the Eden Prairie Preschool Education Association. This morning, I am here to lend my voice of support for House File 2281. Currently, our state has two of the necessary components to fulfill the mission set by the Minnesota Department of Education to have a highly skilled workforce to serve our youngest learners. First, our institutions of higher ed continue to research and design and prepare educators in the specialized pedagogy needed to have highly effective teachers for our youngest learners. And secondly, PELSBY recognizes and certifies the education and the skills of those individuals before issuing that highly specialized early learner teaching license, such as a birth to grade 3 teaching license. But a critical component is currently missing from the equation. The requirement for licensing of preschool teachers and the subsequent definition of teacher under Minnesota state statute. This has become a problematic component for staff, administrators, and students alike. In many districts like my own, preschool classrooms and kindergarten classrooms are in the same elementary schools, side by side. We have educators who have graduated from the same universities, hold the same degree, and hold the same Minnesota teaching license. Yet, depending on which classroom that educator is in, determines whether or not that educator is deemed certified teacher or not. That definition of teacher dictates whether or not the educator is an at-will employee, how they are or are not bound by probationary periods, what salary and benefits they receive, and whether or not they have rights to join the bargaining unit with other staff who also hold Minnesota teaching licenses. And as a result, the mission to have highly trained and effective educators for our youngest learners is failing. Because we are seeing those educators who love engaging with those preschool students leave the preschool classrooms to teach kindergarten right next door or third grade three doors down. And we are seeing administration having to lower their expectations in the hiring processes to get an adult into that preschool classroom.
I'll maybe ask you to wrap up the next minute if you can.
Thank you. In addition, we're seeing high turnover rates and instructors who are lacking the adequate preparation. As the only public preschool option for families in my community, that is unconscionable. And so I thank the authors of the bill who bring this important bill to light, not only for the high quality preschool education our youngest learners deserve, but also for the inclusion of the collective bargaining rights and the grow your own teacher aspects, for which it is crucial to promote the return of the already licensed educators back into our preschool classrooms. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for your testimony and your work. Before you leave, I think the representative from Eden Prairie possibly had, do you want something now? Yeah, Representative Katiz Batoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Dominic, for coming in, Ms. Kirkpatrick, excuse me, to coming in and speaking on this today. It was something that I was going to address as well, but it's so great that you are here to kind of shed a little bit more light than I could have possibly done on an issue that I'm hearing from our preschool teachers on a weekly basis. I'm a mom of a 2.5-year-old, so I'm frequently at our lower campus building and in touch with all of our ECFE and parent educators and preschool teachers, and it's a big concern. And I understand that we've lost wonderful teachers to districts surrounding who are paying more. We're able to pay more. I know that the preschool program has just, like you mentioned, shifted, and teachers have moved to the elementary classrooms. And I think that this is common sense. And I guess to Representative Hill,
actually, hold on a second, because we do have another testifier, and so I want to get the member.
Apologize.
Yeah, no problem. I called on you because I thought you just wanted to give an Eden Prairie Eagles shout out to the testifier.
Okay.
So maybe we'll get back to you if that's okay.
Okay,
yeah.
Certainly.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So, Ms. Kirkpatrick, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good. And then we've got final testifier Brianna Ostoff as public testifier, so slightly different situation. And so come on up, and once you get settled in, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony. We've got just probably about 2 minutes we can do, so please, welcome.
I'm Bri Ostoff. Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Bri Ostoff, and I serve as the Director of Community Education for Farmington Area School District. Today, I represent Minnesota Community Education Association in sharing that we have concerns about House File 2281. Specifically, Section 1 will provide challenges to school districts and early childhood workforce. Currently, the bill states that any person providing instruction for a school district or charter school based early education program must have a Minnesota teaching license by July 2027. This provision will require any current early education instructor without their early education license in a school district or charter school to go to college to obtain an early education teaching license. Many of these instructors will have to become full-time undergraduate students for 4 years and take a leave to complete the student teaching requirements. Under the current bill, there is no legacy clause to support many current early education instructors who don't have teaching license. Many of these teachers have put in years of working in preschool classrooms. They have attended their school district's yearly trainings. They have trained in implementing curricula. They have developed curricula, and many have attained early childhood trainings provided by early childhood professionals. Currently, in the field of early childhood education, especially pre-kindergarten, there is a large group of instructors who will leave the field rather than go back to school for many reasons. Most people under 20 years away from retirement are saving for their retirement or paying for their children to go to college. The difficulty to go back to school for the short time left in their careers would not be worth the financial and time debt it would cost them. Others in the profession have found this career after they've been stay-at-home parents, and they have degrees in other fields, but they stayed because they love kids. They will leave to go to work in a profession of their original degrees rather than go back to school. Lastly, we have many people in this profession who started as assistants and have worked their way up, trained by us as districts. They entered the workforce without college degrees because it is what they needed to do to support themselves and their families. They do not have the funds to go or time to go back to school full time or the ability to go unpaid for a semester during student teaching. While the Tier 1 and Tier 2 pathways is available for these early learning instructors, it only prolongs the inevitability if they choose not to go back to school. Districts will only employ a Tier 1 or Tier 2 teacher for so long because there are time limits on these tiers. Also, every year a district will need to post their position and wait to establish that they cannot find a licensed early educator and prove that they were not able to fill the position.
I'll ask you to wrap up if you
yep.
can. Thanks.
Yep, and I've experienced this loss in other programs. Early education, childhood education cannot afford a mass exodus at this time.
Thank you so much. Thanks for your testimony. Thanks for your work. Is there any other public member of the public who wishes to testify? So not seeing any, so we can finally go back to Representative Katiza Watoon, so you can ask your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Hill, for bringing this bill forward. I'm signed on as a co-author. I think it makes a lot of sense. And I wanted to say I'm particularly grateful that we've included the section on exemptions so that people who do, you know, are currently working in these school or charter school-based settings, that they have 4 years to get their degree in place so that, you know, they don't have to step away from this role. And I think that sort of addresses what the last testifier just brought forward. I know it's a time-based situation, but I hope that with some of the other solutions that I know that you and Chair Pryor are working through in the Education Policy Committee this year, that we can help mitigate any sort of mass exodus in this arena. But I really appreciate you bringing this bill forward.
Thank you, Representative Katiza Watoon. Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you, Representative Hill. In listening to this, I have great concern for rural Minnesota. We're in a workforce shortage. I've had my kids in home-based programs, and I've had them in center-based programs in rural Minnesota. And I think it's going to be very concerning. While we are giving people in this bill 4 years, that's not the path everybody wants to take, and there's some excellent early childhood instructors that don't have a four-year degree right now. And in a workforce that we have right now, I think this is very short-sighted. It's going to hurt rural Minnesota tremendously at a time when we don't have the programs available to people. It is not set up the same way as Minneapolis-St. Paul. We don't have in the suburb area the access to as many programs. In some of the communities, there aren't anything. And so to limit the people that have been daycare providers or other experienced people, mothers and fathers that have phenomenal skill set and have taken classes and learned for this early childhood learning, I think that's a real miss for Minnesota to not have those people available, and to force them to get a four-year degree is not, I think, the path we need to go. And we're talking about early childhood learning here, and I think that each district has the opportunity then to determine what their needs are, because they know their community. They know what their community needs is. And if I'm listening to the presenters, most have the certification, so it's available to them. And then in many fields, there's always a pathway where people move between things. It's that way in healthcare. LPNs become RNs. There's CNAs become LPNs. They move in different roles between preschool and kindergarten teachers and different things. And the pay grades are going to be different for scope and responsibility, and also for what the district needs are and what the geographic area needs. So I just have great concern that we are taking away people that have already proven themselves to be great in preschool. So I would caution us on what we're really going to accomplish. And while we may have some great accomplishments in one area, it's going to significantly hurt rural Minnesota.
I'll invite Representative Hill to respond if he wishes.
Yes, and thank you, Representative, for the comments and the concern. A couple of things that I want to point out. Number one, I am certainly open. It is our hope that this bill is laid over to be considered in the future, and I am certainly open to ongoing dialogue to finding the right balance point should there be one out there that could emerge with legacy language as, forgive me, I don't want to mispronounce her last name, Ms. Ostorf spoke about. This is important. Another point I'd like to make is that there is no intention of harming greater Minnesota or any region of Minnesota as we work through this. Our hope here is to making sure that, as you said, we are certainly addressing early childhood education and our most important opportunity to invest in our young people. And so finding that right landing spot and making sure that our students are getting what they need, and also ensuring that our practitioners are receiving what they have earned. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. It looks like Representative Zalesnikar, maybe you want me to go back to you, Representative Zalesnikar, move on? Okay, you're all good. Mm-hmm. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hill. You mentioned the right balance point. To me, the right balance point is local control, allowing the independent school district, to have the control over this issue, because I believe right now they can already require this of early learning educators, can they not?
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Representative, yes, that is an opportunity that districts individually have. I think that the reason why this bill is so important, in the issue has been a light has been shown on this issue, is that because of this technicality, these teachers are left in a vulnerable position. And what I've seen during my nearly 25 years as a public education teacher is that when our colleagues are in vulnerable positions, it's our students who suffer. And so working to provide the conditions on the ground that our teachers deserve, in so ensuring that they have the training they need to provide the best possible outcomes for our kids, That's what we are seeking with the outcome here. Thank you.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, that is the goal. What's best for the child? And this is a one-size-fits-all approach again. The local school district knows what's best for their kids, and if the parents don't like that, they'll put in a new school board. They'll put in new leadership. This is going to hurt, as Representative Zeliznikar already brought up. This is potentially going to very much hurt greater Minnesota. And again, we have another example of the heavy hand of government coming down with rules and regulations saying, we're going to make you do this, whether you want to or not. They already have the authority to do that. Let's continue to empower our school districts locally to make this decision for themselves. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'm going to move to Representative Coulter.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hill, for bringing this forward. And, you know, I guess the way I approach this bill is, I think, in very much in the same sort of vein that we've had a lot of conversations in this committee, in that really it is time for us to be treating early childhood care and education in many ways the same way we treat K-12 education. We have statewide standards for licenses and so on that every K-12 teacher in the state of Minnesota has to abide by. And I don't know that I hear anybody saying that that's a problematic position, that we shouldn't have these statewide standards, and I think we should. And, you know, we've spent a lot of time talking in this committee about how important early care and education is in terms of the amount of brain development that occurs and all of that. So if anything, these standards, that we should expect of our teachers, if anything, to me, that's more important for early care and education. And I think that's why Section 1 is so critical in this bill. And, you know, in terms of the exact language, as far as folks who are doing the work now, I think certainly Representative Hill indicated a willingness to work on that, and I think there is some room to work on that. But I think Section 2 is also really, really important because it ensures that folks who are doing this work are able to join their bargaining unit, that they're able to get the pay and the benefits and all the other things that teachers should expect. And so I think, you know, like I said, what it really comes down to is just recognizing that early childhood teachers are teachers and should be treated the same way we treat every other teacher in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Perez Vega. Representative Perez Vega, and then we'll grab Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Chair. excuse me. Representative Hill, I appreciate the extended time for those teachers, preschool teachers that are not licensed, to have the accessibility and ability to have a couple years to work on this, you know, the process of, and also the ability for a lot in my community, in our district, we have a lot of preschool teachers that are not English-speaking teachers that are working with children who don't speak English while they're learning English at the same time. These are the programs that only give an amplification of the support that those teachers need in that environment alongside those children to grow. And it's an opportunity where you're giving access through this bill time. I mean, you're seeing July 1st, 2027, where teachers that are voluntary maybe be a little scared that, oh, I don't know if I can obtain this license. I don't know if the challenges I'm up to face, but it's allowing opportunity for them to receive better pay, better benefits, and be a part of being honored with that license. And I'm really supportive of this in regards to that, giving them the opportunity to get their license by 2027. Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll take the bait, Representative Coulter, and go ahead and say that, yeah, I do think there are issues with the K-12 system and that are caused in no small part by the top-down, centralized, one-size-fits-all approach to that system. And I think it's reflected in part by, on the low end, on the generous end, 50% of our students not being able to read at grade level. That's indicative of a systemic failure. This bill seems intent upon, I mean, the only folks who we know are going to benefit from it are the union. They're going to benefit.
Whether or not it's going to be a benefit to the students or the teachers is an open question. But I think when we contemplate the fact that there is local control, this is an option that's already available to school districts. If we assume that they're acting in good faith and we assume that their desire is the best possible outcomes for students and parents in their community, which I think is a very fair assumption, then we should accept the fact that those who have chosen not to mandate this have done so because in their judgment, it's going to provide the best outcomes for their students. And, you know, this has the potential to have the impact of increasing cost and operational difficulty for districts in a time when we're looking for ways to expand the pool of teachers in the K-12 system, provide alternative paths, alternative licensure. So we've already recognized in the K-12 system that we need to make it easier to approach these positions rather than increase the standards in order to make it more difficult. I do have one question for the author or any of his testifiers. When we talk about, there's language in here on line 113 referring to school-based early education programs. What all does that include? Would that include things like child care centers that are providing school readiness or VPK as part of a mixed delivery system?
And that may be something that our House research can help with. Representative, would you rather do that? Ms. Mock, we'll see if you can help us shed some light on that.
Thank you, Chair Pennell. Why don't we start there?
Okay, we'll do that. Ms. Mock. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So these would only be teachers who are actually employed by a school district or a charter school.
And so, Representative Hudson, hopefully that's helpful. Okay, good. Yep, thanks. Okay, so Representative Hill, you get the last word on your bill.
Well, once again, I want to thank you, Chair Pennell, for hearing the bill and for members of the committee for the opportunity for this rich dialogue. A couple of things come to mind as I bring this to a close. Number one, it's not in dispute. There's nobody in this room at your table that won't agree that investing in our youngest learners is key and wise and the right thing to do, in my estimation. What we need to ensure is that local communities, local school districts, local teams of administrators have the opportunity to do the right thing by the professionals. And I use that term on purpose. I do use it with intention. The professionals who stand before these kids. I've had the opportunity to take part in early childhood programming as a parent. I've had the opportunity as a colleague to see these folks in action. And I've had the opportunity in another role that I fulfilled to go on home visits with early childhood educators to see the incredible work that they do. It's integral to the work that we do in serving our kids and ensuring that the next generation has everything they need to become the people they want to be. So I urge your support and thank you for the opportunity, Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Representative Hill. Thanks to the members for the discussion. With that, the chair lays over House File 2281 as amended for possible inclusion in the committee budget bill. And thanks to your testifiers to all of them for their work. So I'm going to bring up Representative Hassan. House File 2514, and I will ask Vice Chair Keeler if I can to move House File 2514 to bring that before the committee.
So move.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. Representative Hassan, I don't see any author's amendments. Welcome to the committee, and please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good morning, everyone. I want to thank you for the opportunity to present House File 2514, which supports the YWCA Minneapolis Early Childhood Education Program. As we all know, early learning is important. And here is reasons why early learning is important, especially for children from lower income families. They're less likely to repeat a grade in school. They're less likely to be identified as having special needs, more prepared academically for later grades, and more likely to graduate from high school, and more likely to be higher earners in the workforce. House File 2514 supports the YWCA Minneapolis Early Childhood Education Program, which provided engaging, holistic early learning environment for infants to school-age children. YWCA program nurtures positive and positive social, emotional, and academic habits in children through stimulating activities, nutritious food, and anti-bias curriculum. They offer a full-day childcare program that are 4-star rated and parent aware. They also provide, they also take kids to field trips to cultural and historical sites throughout the community. In 2019 to 2020, YWCA Minneapolis exceeded outcome for the 720 students they serve, with 91% of their preschoolers entering kindergarten proficient in school readiness program. So House File 2514 appropriates, asks for appropriation for $550,000 one-time grant to YWCA Minneapolis to support early childhood education. And with that, Mr. Chair, I have a couple testifiers who are going to explain more of this appropriation and what the impact of it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I invite your testifier to come on up. And once you get settled in, identify yourself, please, and then proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay, great. And I think it's just me. Unless you have specific questions, we have some others who may be able to speak to them better. So
we are good with good at specific questions.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Pinto and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Luna Allen Bakarian, and I serve as the public policy manager for YWCA Minneapolis. We are grateful to be here this morning, and it is good to see several of you again, whom we saw at Minnesota Child Care Association Day on the Hill, or whom we've met with individually previously. I'm here to speak in support of House File 2514 in support of our organization. I'd like to take this time to tell you more about our work, specifically about our early childhood education. YWCA Minneapolis is one of over 200 local associations under YWCA USA, all sharing the same mission of eliminating racism, empowering women and girls, and promoting peace, justice, freedom, and dignity for all. YWCA associations nationwide work toward this mission in our community in a variety of ways. Our organization, YWCA Minneapolis, uplifts our mission in several ways, impacting over 15,000 Minnesotans in our last fiscal year. One of the primary ways we do so is through early childhood education. We run 5 early childhood education centers in Minneapolis and St. Paul for children aged 6 weeks through school age. 2 centers are located within our downtown and midtown health and wellness center buildings in Minneapolis. One is located at Abbott Northwestern Hospital in the district of the lead author. This is a site that remained open during the height of the pandemic, serving emergency workers. Our other centers continued to open in waves to support families, meaning that several of our educators were eligible for last year's frontline worker payments. And 2 are located in St. Paul, 1 out of the Hub's Lifelong Learning Center on University, represented by co-author Hussein, and 1 out of the Ecolab building in downtown St. Paul in the district of Representative Perez Vega. Our centers support families across diverse identities, and our enrollees include CCAP-eligible families, families receiving income-eligible scholarships provided by us, and private-pay families. The young people who spend their days at YWCA Minneapolis ECE sites engage in high-quality play-based curriculum that teaches about difference in developmentally appropriate ways. They take swim lessons, they learn about wellness, and they engage with neighborhood environments. All families in their first year of ECE care at YWCA Minneapolis are offered free memberships to our health and wellness centers. Like many early childhood education centers, challenges we've faced in recent years include drops in enrollments, struggles to recruit educators, cuts in funding, and working to increase educator salaries without increasing rates for families. Because these challenges are intertwined with the other policy areas and bills that this committee and the legislature at large is considering this session and beyond, we are active members of several coalitions working on the intersecting issues of early childhood education affordability, increased teacher salaries, and increased supports for recruitment and retention of teachers of color in our state. I am in awe of my colleagues who lead our classrooms. Children leave our programs ready for their next steps in kindergarten and beyond, having received the bonus quality care that comes from culturally informed teaching. Our need for funding stems from a few key areas. One of our larger funders pulling back a large portion of funding in order to support internal programs. Seeing increased social emotional needs in the children and families we serve, which requires more supports for families and staff. A continued need for scholarships for the families who are moving off of benefits but still require some support for paying for care in a private pay capacity, and our annual occupancy costs continuing to rise, likely to the tune of at least $200,000. We are seeking an appropriation to continue to bolster the over 450 families who benefit from our ECE programs, confident that the ripple effects into our communities are tenfold. Thank you very much for hearing our bill. I strongly encourage your support, and on behalf of our organization, thank you for the work you are doing daily for our youngest Minnesotans.
Juan, thank you for the work that you're doing daily. It's really important. Glad to have you here.
Thanks to our teachers.
To your teachers, the great work they do. Any member of the public wishes to testify on this bill, first of all? So not seeing any member questions or discussion at all. Members? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You touched on it briefly. Why this appropriation is necessary in spite of the fact that, you know, as a four-star rated program, I assume that you're receiving the maximum amount of early learning scholarships and receiving CCAP reimbursements, and we've now are in the process of making permanent the child care stabilization grant. So there's all sorts of funding that other child care providers in the state are receiving, you're receiving as well. And so the reason to provide this particular appropriation that's available directly and explicitly for YWCA Minneapolis is because you've had, if you could just restate that for me, because you've had some contributors who've pulled back funding.
Sure. I'm actually going to invite our Vice President of Early Childhood Education to speak to that, but I also do want to point out, I think we sit in a unique spot because of supports, again, for families who are between benefits and private pay, especially as private pay rates continue to increase. But Stephanie, do you want to speak to that?
Come on up, and once you sit down, if you could just identify yourself before beginning to answer President Hudson's question.
Thank you, Chair Pinto and committee members. I'm Stephanie Thomas from the YWCA. Minneapolis, sorry. And yes, I think that's a portion of it. We are unique. Our child care programs had a loss last year, even with those grant supports and NACE funding and those pieces. And they were budgeted for a loss this year. We are having an increased occupancy cost that they've identified already for us for the next, it'll be ongoing, but next year. And one of our major funders had to refocus their funding internally to maintain what they were doing with kids. And so those two things can't be quickly shifted. So we're asking for this to have us continue to develop what needs to be developed in the future to be able to support that ongoing need without having an impact to our community that we serve. Our programs are also unique, as Luna pointed out, in that we serve a lot of families who do get CCAP, who do get assistance, but we also serve those families who, as they're maintaining jobs and getting off of assistance, have that cliff effect, where we then step in as an organization to assist them in being able to maintain childcare. And so, in able to do that, it does require us to raise ongoing funds to support that, and we're seeing that need continue and increase.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you anticipate that you'll be able to identify ways to raise or manage ongoing funds in the future so that we won't have to continue to appropriate state funds?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't get your last name.
Thomas, yes.
Thomas, Ms. Thomas.
Yes. We have an organizational advancement department that will be working on that because of those quick shifts and the place we're in with people going back to work and the supports that we need along with that all that's going on in the community. But that's our goal, and that's what we have been able to do in the past.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you. My question is on the funding structure. Is there a percentage change that happened from whether it's, I don't know if you call it corporate sponsorships or the relationship you have with businesses and various entities that bring in monies into for the YWCA? Is there a percentage that changed from 2020 to 2021 to 2022? Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Ms. Thomas.
Yeah, I don't know if I have an answer to a percentage change. We have ongoing development and a specific funder who had determined an ongoing gift for us and then was not able to do that because of their own internal needs, that they just did not fund anyone in early childhood. They shifted that funding. I don't know the answer to your percentage question.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Thank you. And maybe I could just ask you, how much do you depend on from philanthropy or other entities? How much is in your budget for that?
I bet a significant proportion, but let's see, Ms. Thomas.
I mean, across all of our programs, there's a lot of different ways. I mean, some is donated space, some is, money given directly to scholarships, some to program, but we raise over $1 million.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. So the $550,000 one-time grant is covering a gap from funding that was there from a private donor.
Ms. Thomas.
Public donor, and not solely that, but yes, I mean, there's that. There's also the fact that some space that we had is now going to be a cost because, again, many businesses can no longer just give free space anymore. So there's increased cost in occupancy. There is that one funder and a need, an increased need from our families to continue to fund people, you know, as food is more expensive and all these other pieces. Our parents are having a larger gap if they're not on assistance in being able to meet the needs of child care. So those scholarships assist with that.
And I do want to go to the bill's author, Representative Hassan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative. As someone who has a three-year-old in preschool and have had her in child care during the pandemic, I can tell you that those rates kept going up and up, and it's as much as my mortgage now. Mm-hmm. So there is that need for families, an increased need for families, because if you have to choose between taking your child to child care and paying your mortgage, and if you don't take your child to child care, then who's going to go to work and earn that money to pay for your mortgage? So I think that there, as you know, our world gets more expensive and our income is stuck and it's not increasing. Families are really, the need for support for families is imminent right now.
Representative Lesnicker.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you, Representative Hassan. And I understand that. I just wanted to understand the sources of the funding, because what I struggle with is when we as a committee are giving grant money and an organization has people making $100,000, several of them, and a CEO making over $200,000, that is a business model, and it's no different than the for-profit business. And so it is through a grant that's important. But I struggle with that because I, too, want to make sure we have children cared for. But this is, you know, when we're looking at health care issues, you know, we have people in for-profit, non-profit settings, whether it's nursing homes or other, they're not making anything close to this. So we have, I think, a responsibility to look at where we're funding our money and then what the responsibility is within the leadership, whether it's a grant, we're funding it. And so we have a responsibility to look at that. And I would hope that the YWCA would, I'm not questioning the intent of the program or anything like that. I'm just making a statement that I think is concerning. And I'm asked that many times by citizens. Why is this? And so I don't have the answer for that. And I'm not making a statement that what they do is not valuable, but is this the system we're going to have where we're funding through grants, which is through state of Minnesota money and taxpayer money, salaries that are exceeding the private business too? Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to move on, I think, unless I don't think we had anybody else signed up at this point, so I'm going to do that. But Representative Lee, you had... I would want to be quick if you can. We've got one more bill to hit, but did you have something quick?
Sure. Yeah, I can be very, very quick. I think I just want to refocus the discussion on the impact of what this money will do. And if anyone has managed nonprofit funding before, there are restrictions on, like, the money that you get, and there are also restrictions on administrative fees. And so
You know, I think we want people to be properly compensated. And I think whatever the salary is of the folks, right, it doesn't, because you guys braid in private funding and foundational funding, it doesn't necessarily mean that this money is going to go pay for a CEO's salary. So I just want to make sure that, we remember that as a committee, we've talked a lot about how the return on investment when we invest in our children under five actually benefits society as a whole, up to 13, 16 times more later. And so I want to make sure folks keep that in mind. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Yeah, and Representative Hassan, I will give you the final word on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for this wonderful conversation. As opportunity gaps between our poorest and richest Minnesotans become larger than ever, it's our duty to make sure that children are ready for kindergarten and that they get the quality care that they need and exposure to early childhood education when they enter in that classroom. Because what is happening right now is that we keep talking about the disparities that exist in education, but those disparities start before even our kids step into these classrooms. And it's, as state leaders, we can do something about that. We can reduce those disparities, and early childhood education is the key. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much, Robert Hassan, and to your testifiers. Thanks for your really important work. We really appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you. And with that, the chair lays over House File 2514. For possible inclusion in the committee's budget bill. And then the final bill, Representative Pryor, come on up, House File 1994. I'm going to ask Vice Chair Keeler to move House File 1994 to bring that before the committee as well.
I move House File 1994 before us.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. And Representative Pryor, so glad to have you back with us. And please, I see no author's amendment, so please dive into presenting your bill.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for committee for hearing my bill today. I want to talk about Parent Child Plus. This is a group that I first learned about back in 2017. A couple of folks came to my office to describe about this incredible program that is very much evidence-based. It's got a long history, but it's always a part of that history has always been about best practices. And so what this does, Parent Child Plus, is you have trained, qualified individuals that can go into homes and work with parents to help them teach their children those basic early learning skills that really develop the brain. And I know that this is a committee that understands what we're talking about when we're talking about those early learning experiences. So I'm going to turn it over to my testifier to give you the details, but I guess I'm here just to talk about my enthusiasm for it. And also to say this is not new to this body, but it's an organization that we've supported through the years, and it's received bipartisan support, we're just in a new phase of being able to get it out into our communities across Minnesota.
Okay, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Committee Chair Pinto, and thank you, Representative Pryor, as well, too. My name is Christy Murray, and I am with Jewish Family and Children's Services of Minneapolis, and I am the program manager of Parent Child Plus. Parent Child Plus is an international program that is based out of New York, and we were able to bring it here to Minnesota in 2006. It's a home visiting program that works with families to promote and creative ways to learn and for children to acquire language through play. It enhances parenting skills, and it helps children to prepare for school. As indicated by the name, Parent Child Plus focuses on parents as their child's first and most important teacher. This is an intensive home visiting program. We begin working with families when children are between the ages of 16 months to 2.5 years old, and we have trained early learning specialists who go into their homes twice a week for 30 minutes for 2 academic years. Each week, we provide an educational book and toy that is the families to keep for their educational library. And, of course, I had to bring toys and books with, too. So here's just a few examples. And if you want to play with them, go ahead. We are located, our original locations were in the Twin Cities metro area and in Cass County. We were able to more recently expand to other communities in greater Minnesota in St. Cloud, Rochester, and Rice County. This year, we were able to serve 308 children. 186 of those children were here in the Twin Cities metro and 140 of them in greater Minnesota. This program produces great outcomes, and in your packet you will find the 2021-22 annual report to the Minnesota Department of Education where our funding is received from the state, and also a handout that kind of highlights more about the program and the families that we're serving. I want to also note we do receive some additional funding through at Jewish Family and Children's Services, and one of our philanthropic funders did some research about the work that we do, and what they found is that for every dollar that our program receives, it has a return on investment of $5.55. So it is definitely worth the investment. We respectfully ask that you support House File 1994. This bill provides a base funding increase, which is needed to sustain the program's recent expansion into greater Minnesota. Currently, our level of base funding is $1.8 million per biennium. In 2017, which was probably when Representative Pryor was able to connect with our program as well too, the legislature passed a one-time appropriation so that we could scale up in greater Minnesota, and we certainly did that. Those funds were able to build partnerships with other nonprofits throughout the state. In Rochester, we were able to connect with Intercultural Mutual Assistance Association. In St. Cloud, we partnered with Promise Neighborhood of Central Minnesota. And in Rice County, we're working with Healthy Communities Initiative, and we're serving in both Faribault and Northfield.
And I should say, we've got two more testifiers and only 3 minutes total, so you probably should wrap up if you can.
Okay, sounds good. In August of 2021, the state of Minnesota provided a one-time rescue plan appropriation for expanding to these sites, and that funding will be ending in 2023. Our current level of base funding directs expenses for about 176 families each year, and we are serving about 300 across all five sites. House File 1994 would provide $1.8 million increase per biennium, bringing Parent-Child Plus base funding to $3.6 million per biennium. This increase is needed in order to sustain the programming that we have been able to expand across the state. And we're very grateful to the governor's administration, to the Minnesota Bold Literacy Initiative, that includes this increase in the base funding. I am going to turn it over to our other testifiers. I just want to also direct you to your packets that one of our Greater Minnesota partners from Rochester, there is a letter of support from Armin Dimlick, who is the executive director from Rochester, and then we'll have Leslie Lamone come up to share her testimony from Rice County.
Thank you. Yeah, I'd like the testifiers to come out. Actually, so we've got about 2 minutes for both, 1 minute per testifier at this point. We're
okay.
Pretty tight on time. I do appreciate you pointing out, though, as the testifier makes her way up to members, that this proposal is in the governor's budget proposal, and I want to highlight that as we have individual bills up. So welcome, and please identify yourself. And again, we're very tight on time. My apologies, but please identify and proceed.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Pinto and members of this committee. My name is Leslie Limone, and I'm the director of Parent Child Plus in Rice County, and also a Growing Up Healthy Coordinator. In 2019, we launched the Parent Child Plus program, and we served 15 families. We are currently serving 56 families in Northfield and Faribault, and we serve a diverse community. The majority of the families that we work with are Spanish-speaking only. We do have staff that are bilingual, English and Spanish. We go in the home, we bring a toy or a book weekly, we sit with the parent, we model what reading time or playtime should look like. A lot of the families have never had a book in their home.
I'm going to invite you to back off a tiny bit from the microphone. It's a little bit loud.
Oh, sorry.
That's okay. No, it's picking you up very well.
Yeah. Have never had a book or a toy in the home. So when we're there, we show the parents how to play, how to read. We also have books and toys that are, or the books that are in Spanish. So We're there to model. Besides that, we're also there to identify any resources that they may need. We help them get connected to resources within the community. We provide the tools, and our goal is to empower the families so that they're able to navigate themselves through the system, and they're able to be self-sufficient. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks. And to our final testifier, please identify yourself and proceed.
My name is John Smith. I'm from Promise Neighborhood of Central Minnesota. I'm the executive director. Thank you, Chair Pinto and other committee members. We started our after-school program 8 years ago, and a year later we realized that we need to push back a little further because the kids were coming to us with multiple issues in first grade and kindergarten and second grade. We've had a huge impact, not just with kids being better prepared for academically for school, but additionally our kids are experiencing less out-of-school time and out-of-class time because of behavior. Our parents and siblings in the home have improved mentoring and parenting skills, along with skills to be teachers, parents as first teachers. We've been able to hire and train community members that have been involved with our organization. We just would like to continue to get the support from you all. Thanks.
Thanks so much. Thanks to both of you for your really important work. Are there any other members of the public who wish to testify on the bill? Okay, not seeing none. So member questions or discussion? Representative Lesnikar. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you, Representative Pryor. My question is, this has been a established, evidence-based program, is what I understand, which is wonderful. Have you found, is this program requiring 4-year degrees right now?
And actually, before you answer it, I forgot about this. If I can ask the pages, maybe you could pass around the little the things that you have in front of you, Ms. Thomas.
Oh,
or,
the books and toys?
Yeah, the books and toys.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think you probably want to look at that. So you,
if you need that. To unpack.
Oh, just hold on. You've got a page coming to get it from you. Yeah. Okay, but then the question for Representative Lesnikar was about 4-year degrees, if you could answer that.
Thank you for your question. It is not a requirement of Parent-Child Plus for our early learning specialists to have a 4-year degree. The supervisors, there is an education requirement, but there is a requirement of at least 16 hours of training that is geared towards preparing them, and then we do ongoing training at our weekly team meetings as well, too. So it is not a requirement for them to have a 4-year degree.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. And thank you. How many years has your program been in existence?
Yes, thank you.
Ms. Murray, pardon me, I had the mixing up. Ms. Murray.
Yeah, thank you, Committee Chair, and thank you, Representative. It's an international program based out of New York, and they established the program in 1965. So there is a long history of evidence-based research that went into the development of this program. And as you can see on some of the handouts, there has been tracking of children that have been a part of this program that their high school graduation rates increased by over 30% compared to students who do not go through this program. And also the children are 50% more likely to be ready for kindergarten and 50% less likely to need special education by the third grade.
Representative Lesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you. I'm amazed since 1965. That's a lot of experience, and that's a lot of evidence-based that we have for the state of Minnesota. And it seems to me that if you had to have a 4-year degree, would it affect how many people would be able to be employed in your operation to serve the people?
Ms. Murray.
Yes, thank you, Committee Chair, and thank you, Representative. It would greatly impact that, because one of the things that we value is being able to hire from within the communities that we're serving. And so we are able to provide our programming in English, Spanish, Somali, and Russian this year. We also have provided it in Hmong in the past as well, too. And by being able to have staff who come from the communities, we also have staff who have actually been graduates of the program who became staff with us, and were able to create a career path for themselves. So we often see this as a two-generation workforce development program.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you for that. I guess I'm really excited to see that it's evidence-based. It's been here since 1965, and you're helping multiple cultures. You're working with a two-prong approach, not just the children but the parents for the workforce. You're working with people that do English as a second language. I have a friend who's from Ukraine and an interpreter, and so I'm looking at the graduation rates. I'm looking at the reading readiness. It looks like it's 95-98%, which is pretty good marks. And so congratulations. I mean, I just think that having flexibility and having the right people be able to education is one mark of what we're going to have for children. But as the pediatricians earlier said, that heart, that experience, that smile, that personality that a supervisor can interview for, I think is showing that it's been successful. So thank you for what you do.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative, for bringing forth this bill. I just have a question for the testifier. I noticed on here I serve a portion of Cass County. I'm just curious, what area in Cass County does it serve?
Thank you, Committee Chair. Thank you, Representative. We are in two different communities in Cass County. So we are in the Reamer area, working with the Northland Family Area Family Service Center, and then also in Pine River Bacchus. But one of the amazing things about the work that they're doing there is it's very rural. And so the early learning specialists are putting on average, about 500 miles a week in order to have families that otherwise wouldn't be able to access these early education critical moments and development that these tools that they need. So this really does help to reach everyone in Minnesota.
Davis?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much.
Good. Okay. Not seeing other questions or comments, and so we're going to go to Chair Pryor for the final word on the bill. Chair Pryor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members, for the questions and clarification that my wonderful testifier has been able to provide. It's a program that we like to talk about, love talking about, and are excited to continue forward. I also want to just highlight one of the comments that we heard from a previous testifier. They looked at children get to kindergarten, children get to first grade, children get to second and third grade, and say, wow, we did not start soon enough. And so I think that's one of the messages that this bill makes clear and this program makes clear, is that we need to really get down to early childhood and those first months, those first weeks even, those first 1,000 days, and say, how can we support children in this case, supporting families when we're talking about kids that young? And this is a great program for doing it, and really appreciate your support.
Thank you so much, Chair Pryor. And I was glad to hear this bill and then hear that Way to Grow a proposal from Representative Hill earlier relating to home visiting. And it's such a powerful, as we've seen from the evidence, it's such a powerful opportunity for families. So, Chair Pryor, thank you, and to the testifier as well, and all the testifiers on this bill, for your work. So with that, the chair lays over House File 1994 for possible inclusion of the committee's budget bill. So members, we are back on tonight at 6:30 with a bunch of bills, so be ready for that. And so with that, the committee stands in recess. Thank you. Okay, well, I am calling back to order this meeting of the House Committee on Children, Families, Finance, and Policy. Thanks all. Sorry that we're starting a couple minutes late, I guess only a couple. And so we're going to call Representative Clardy down to present her bill. And I'll apologize in advance to members of the public both here to testify, is that we're going to be trying to move relatively quickly because we got a bunch of bills and we're meeting in the evening, in case you had not noticed. But we'll make it work, and it's going to be okay. Still light out. Thank goodness. Yes, it is still light out. Some of us are taking a couple days to adjust to that daylight savings time thing. I don't know about the rest of you, but challenging. So, Representative Clardy, you have House File 1806, and I guess I'll invite a motion to bring that bill before the committee. Do that.
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Coulter. So Representative Coulter moves House File 1806, bring that before the committee. And maybe Representative Coulter, you would be willing to then move the Representative Clardy, you would like to have the DE2 amendment adopted?
Yes.
Okay. Representative Coulter, would you please move the DE2 amendment on behalf of Representative Clardy?
So moved.
Okay. And Representative Clardy, can you just give us a sense as to the DE2? Looks like it kind of expands on your original bill and provides some more detail. Anything you want to say about the DE2?
No, basically I'm going to be covering it, but it just was done in conjunction with the Department of Education, so more of the technical aspects.
Wonderful. Okay. Any discussion, members, to the DE2 amendment? Hearing none, all in favor of approval of the DE2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. Motion passes. The DE2 is adopted, and 1806 is in the form you wish. Representative Clardy, please begin.
Great. Mr. Chair, member of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to present House File 1806. This bill establishes statewide kindergarten entrance program. There's been some discussion in the past about moving forward with requiring that Minnesota implements a system of evaluating children upon entrance in kindergarten. This effort comes to us. I'm sorry. This effort comes to us because of the need to make sure that we provide the most effective interventions for children in needs of services at an early age. So, in other words, we're just trying to do a preventative measure. Currently, the Minnesota Department of Education, MDE, has the approval list of vendors for schools and school districts and charter schools to use for kindergarten entry assessments. The use of the entry assessment is voluntary for school districts and charter schools, and the approved list of assessments are aligned with the state's early learning standards. Most states have implemented required kindergarten entrance systems. According to the National Institute for Early Education Research at Rutgers, there are 35 states, including Washington, D.C., that require assessments of children learning and development at kindergarten entry. In 20 states, kindergarten entrance assessment covers all five essential domains of child development. So the DE amendment was developed working closely with the Minnesota Department of Education and provides a new language. It requires the Commissioner of Education to implement a kindergarten entry assessment program based on early learning standards. The school district and the charter schools must choose from a menu of valid and reliable measurements, instruments approved by MDE, and they're aligned to the state's early childhood indicator progress and kindergarten standards and are based on the criteria to be an early learning assessment approved by MDE. It also will support the world's best workforce goal of measuring school readiness and are based in part on information collected by teachers, early professionals, families, and other partners. This legislation will provide an approved list of vendors. That's not a one-size-fits-all, so it's a variety of vendors. The implementation of this program is phased in over 3 years, and with this full implementation by 2025. This will ensure the phased-in approach will ensure that there's integrity within the process, and it ensures that the teachers will receive the effective professional development that's necessary. So the DE amendment includes appropriation to MDE to implement the kindergarten entrance program. So at this point, we are waiting for feedback from MDE on the exact appropriation for the legislation. The bill from 2 years ago appropriated $2 million per year for MDE to implement the program. And I've also included a written testimony from an early education expert, Gigi Winesfield, from the National Institute of Early Education Research, the NEER, at Rutgers University for background as well. So I stand for questions.
Thank you so much. I know that there's a testifier. And I will note for members that fiscal note is still forthcoming on this, and I guess Representative Clardy kind of alluded to that, that she's still waiting for word from the department about kind of what will be necessary to fund this exactly. But of course, all that'll be coming through soon enough. There is one person who signed up in advance to testify, Cindy Cunningham, so please make your way on up and then identify yourself. I ask you to take just no more than 2 minutes, please. And I'm glad to have you. Please.
Thank you. Nice to be back. So I am Cindy Cunningham. I'm a family child care provider in St. Paul, 2 miles up the road. I am also the public policy chair for the State Association for Family Child Care Providers, MCPEN. We have an acronym, of course. My goal in advocacy for family child care is just to make sure that what is passed and stuff is positive, is supportive, and unintended consequences are not present. In this case, we are grateful for the change of the small word from may to must. There are many decisions that you as a body and as a full body make based on, I will say, faulty data when not all schools are required to present, to do the evaluations, and yet our children are deemed not prepared, and yet we don't know fully what that means from a statistical standpoint. So we welcome this. One of the things that we would like as family child care providers, because of some of the messaging and things we get, we would be really interested if in the evaluations that there is an insurance that the question of what was the child's experience before they got to kindergarten, where were they, what were their educational standards, what setting were they in, and then look at where their status is in that assessment so that then we can then best meet the needs of these children before they get to that kindergarten and make sure that we're funneling money and time and effort to the appropriate settings in the appropriate way to make sure that there's accomplishment there. So thank you.
Thanks for your testimony and thanks for your work, Ms. Cunningham. I believe, Representative Clardy, you referenced some handouts, and I think that they were sent in too late to be distributed ourselves, but that there's maybe somebody in the room who has copies for members. Maybe Ms. Guerin, I'm not sure if here, but we can get them distributed. You can get them to a page, perhaps, to distribute if we can have that happen. So is there any other member, while we're doing that, is there any other member of the public who wishes to testify? Not seeing any, so we'll go to member questions. Now, Representative Lesnikar had something, so we'll go to you.
Thank you, Chair Pinto, and thank you, Representative Clardy. My question was what you were alluding to, that if this was a must and in the sense of a mandate, that there would be some way to be looking at what setting and experience the child had before coming to school. Because right now this committee is also looking at where we're doing early childhood scholarships and grants, so we can see correlations between successful measurements and child readiness for kindergarten. So that was something that I was curious about. Thank you.
Yeah, Representative Clardy.
Okay, so just recapping your question, you're trying to see if this is a must. Was that the nature of the question?
Representative Lesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. One question was that with the must, it looks to me like it was changed, the word that we must provide this kindergarten readiness. And with doing that, then, that the questionnaire of doing the readiness would also have an evaluation system for determining where this child was before, what programs they were enrolled in or not enrolled in prior to coming to kindergarten.
Representative Clardy.
That's a great question. I'm probably going to phone a friend to come down. But one thing I do know is that part of the assessment would be based on information that's also given by family or other partners. So we will be gaining some information from people that have been in contact with the child previously. And the focus will be looking at, like, social, emotional, and physical, and language, and cognitive, and, you know, literacy and math. So we'll be collecting the information we have. And then I'd like to, Chair Pinto.
Absolutely. Yeah, we'll have your testifier provide a little more. So please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Chaz Anderson, working here with Representative Clardy on the legislation. I think it's a good point that was been brought up about where the child was previously before the entrance assessment and whether Anata, we can make a correlation and look at the effectiveness of the program they came from previously. So I think that's a good thing that we'll take into consideration. What we tried to do in working with MDE is create time and space. So there's 3 years to implement the program where MDE can do that work, to put in that work to make sure there's some longitudinal data on that point. So we tried to give the language as much flexibility to the department as possible.
So, Representative Lesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. No further questions.
Okay. And then Representative Hemmingson-Yeager.
Thanks. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Cardi. Quick question. So my kids had to go through early childhood screening between 3 and 5 to go in to be like go into kindergarten. Could you just tell me how this would differ or complement that?
And before you go, I'll just note we will have a bill coming up on developmental screening aid that I think will connect to your question as well. So that'll be good. But Representative Clardy or Ms. Anderson, either way.
Chair Pentel, I'm just going to jump in. Prior to this period of time, this specific tool was a voluntary piece. And so we're looking at phasing this into like all the public schools and charter schools with, you know, making sure that integrity there is there by providing a 3-year implementation piece. And as far as how this is different, different schools are using different measurements. So this is something where each school district will have an opportunity to choose from a list of vetted screeners. And so the assessment may look different than what your child had.
Ms. Anderson, to add something to add on that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the understanding is that this assessment would address like the 5 domains of child development, including physical well-being and motor development, social-emotional development, approaches towards learning, language development, and cognitive and general knowledge of the child, so the 5 domains. My understanding, the screening that you're talking about to 3 to 5-year-olds is not as comprehensive. It is more health and medically focused when they screen for the child, like can the child, like vision, hearing, you know, different sort of health related issues. Someone else could speak more to the screening, but that's my understanding.
And I'm actually inclined, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager, we've got somebody from MDE who can maybe provide a little more light as well, if that's okay with you. Yeah, okay, so can I come on up? Okay, good. Identify yourself. Welcome back. And proceed with your answer.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Member Shana Morris, Assistant Director of Government Relations at MDE. And just to sort of compare and contrast the kindergarten entry assessment, this is looking at, I think, trying to create a statewide data set. We don't have that in the early learning space. We don't really get a statewide data set on kiddos until they're in 3rd grade, versus the individual screening that you're talking about is looking at the individual child and what kind of supports might they need and to help them continue on their individual progression, versus a little bit more of a pullback, statewide, systematic, and in particular for policymakers, are we putting money into the right places? Do we need to do a little more over here? Are we doing great over here? Type of a thing.
Okay, Representative Hemmingson-Yeager, anything else?
No, that was really helpful. It's been a few years since I've been through it, and I just remember like there was balance, there was talking, there was counting. So I just wanted to see, but that's really helpful for the clarification. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else from members? I'll maybe just note, and I'll ask Ms. Mock. I had asked previously to give me some information about the kindergarten readiness assessment, and I thought it might be useful, just a minute or two on that, Ms. Mock, if you can, kind of a background on it.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So as you've heard, the kindergarten readiness assessment, MDE may assess incoming kindergartners, so school districts and charter schools can choose to do it, but they don't have to. They do have to use a state-approved assessment tool, and there's $281,000 each year in the base for the kindergarten readiness assessment. There's nothing in current law that requires any school districts or charter schools that provide this assessment to actually report the data back to MDE. And I don't know the numbers offhand, maybe the department can speak to this, but I recall from previous presentations that there are not a lot of school districts or charter schools that currently give the assessment.
Thank you, and I think we're spending $280,000 a year in the base for the KRA in the sort of optional form, and so I think part of the thinking here is we want to have it be something that's being used and it's unclear
how many do school districts are in fact taking advantage of it? Is that right, Ms. Ma?
Yes, my understanding.
Okay, good. Thank you. Okay, so anything else from any other members? Seeing none, so Representative Clardy, final words on your bill.
As a teacher for first grade teacher, actually, for a very long time, and a reading teacher, this bill right here is set up to be preventative and kind of intervention. And the consistency of the assessment tool that's being used across the state will make a difference in, you know, meeting each child's needs when they're, you know, when they first enter the school set. So I think that this is a really good bill and it has great merit. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Clardy. And with that, the chair lays over House File 1806 as amended for possible inclusion in the bill. Again, as I said, we will be getting, expecting to get a fiscal note on this in a sense. Thanks for your work on this and the testifiers for their work as well. I'm inclined to, and I'll check out, we have Representative Colter head on up, and I'm kind of inclined to have the HHF 993, the Developmental Screening Aid Bill, next. I'm sorry for not catching that earlier. I hope that that is okay with you and with your testifiers. Representative Colter, any concern with taking the bills in that order?
I don't need to sit anywhere different, so I'm good.
Okay. Okay. Then in that case, we're going to do that HF 993 then as the next bill. And I assume that it's you are moving HF 993 to bring it before the committee, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And I see no amendments, so please dive on in and present your bill.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So stop me if you've heard this one before, but we're talking about a mandate on school districts that the state does not adequately fund. House File 993 in this state, in this case, relates to state aid provided to school districts to conduct developmental screenings. As Representative Hemmingson-Yeager just mentioned, those of you who are parents of young kids are likely familiar with this. The screening is designed to detect factors that may impede children's learning, growth, and development. It includes a developmental assessment, hearing and vision screening, height and weight measurement, immunization review, and identification of other risk factors that may affect learning. The developmental screening process also provides for a follow-up and referral process if the results indicate a need for it, an interview with parents to discuss assessment, diagnosis, or treatment, as well as a review of health coverage status for any necessary referrals. Developmental screening aid, as you can see in the bill, you'll notice that the aid amounts decrease as children get older because developmental screening aid is designed to incentivize screening at younger ages with the goal obviously being to catch and hopefully address issues earlier on. So there obviously is a sort of vested state interest in this happening earlier. The challenge, of course, is that this particular aid has not been increased since 2008, and costs for, well, everything have continued to increase. An OLA report from 2018 found that the state reimbursement only covered on average about 73% of the costs, and that was, I believe, in fiscal year 2016, with the result that districts had to shell out an additional $1.3 million to cover the remainder of developmental screenings. So I don't think I'm going out too far on a limb by saying that those numbers have probably changed pretty significantly and not in a good way. So with that, I think I will turn things over to my testifier who can use her expertise to delve further.
Okay, sounds good. And please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Oh, thank you, Chair Pinto. My name is Wendy Webster. I serve as the Director of Community Services and Communications for the St. Anthony Wrighton School District. I oversee our early childhood programs for our school district. Thank you, Representative Colter, for authoring this bill. I also am here on behalf of the Minnesota Community Education Association, and I'm here to share the importance of increasing funding for early childhood screening and why the Minnesota Community Education Association supports House File 993. So as Representative Colter shared, the purpose of early childhood screening is to identify potential health or developmental delays in children as young as 3 years of age. Early childhood screening allows school districts the opportunity to partner with parents to assess their children's growth and development to determine if children qualify for additional early childhood services, such as early childhood special education. If left unidentified, these delays could result in the gap when it comes to kindergarten readiness. One piece I do want to add from the discussion earlier is there several pieces that are required by the state for early childhood screening. And so when we conduct an early childhood screening, we have to ask parents for the health and developmental history of their child. And we have to ask parents to fill out two different questionnaires. One is about ages and stages questionnaire, which helps us identify if children's growth and development is developmentally appropriate to where they're at in terms of their age. And the ages and stages questionnaire related to social-emotional development, again, to see if the parents have any concerns regarding what they see from their child's social-emotional behaviors. When families come in for the screening, our staff conduct the hearing and vision screening, and then we also use a state-approved and recognized screening tool. For example, in our district, we use the MIPSI, which is the Minneapolis Preschool Screening Inventory. And then, as we talked about, we look at immunization history with the families, and then we have conversations with the parents to learn if there's any other concerns that we should know about. Representative Coulter shared some of the striking information that came out of the 2018 evaluation report conducted by the OLA. And unfortunately, there is a cross-subsidy across the state, and as we know, it impacts school districts because it really accounts for some of the direct costs that school districts incur in order to conduct early childhood screenings, which is one of three requirements for a child to enter kindergarten in a public school district. They have to be 5 by September 1st, have their immunizations, and the third one is to have an early childhood screening. For example, our colleagues in the Robbinsdale School District have approximately $36,000 in expenses that are not covered by early childhood screening revenue. And in Greater Minnesota, our colleagues in Pequot Lakes lose $12,000 each year in early childhood screening budget.
And I'll probably need to have you wrap up in just a minute.
No problem.
Yeah.
So just want to finish with school districts across the state incur these additional expenses each time we rescreen children and follow up with parents on referrals for vision and hearing screening with the pediatrician, refer children for an early childhood special ed evaluation, and assist parents with community resources to meet families' basic needs. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Any member of the public who would testify on the bill? So seeing none, member questions, discussion? Members? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to speak briefly, offer a thank you, Representative Coulter. It can be difficult to see the member presenting from this angle. I just want to thank you for bringing this bill. Developmental screening is how my wife and I discovered that our eldest son was on the autism spectrum. And prior to that, because he was our only son at the time, no frame of reference, first-time parents, everything's normal. And so we were able to connect him with services, and eventually got an IEP. And there was definitely a period of time where we were deeply concerned about what the prospect of his future looked like. He's 14 now, and he would tell you he knows more than me. And I'm sure there's people who would agree. But this was, in terms of leverage for dollars spent, which is something that's spoken of frequently in this committee, I can attest that this one actually works. So thank you for bringing it.
Good stuff. Thanks, Representative Hudson. Anybody else? Representative Hicks?
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Thank you, Representative Coulter. Autism Parents Unite. Absolutely important for families to have this opportunity, and the amount of meaningful impact that makes long-term is huge. So really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Other questions or members? I should note that there is actually a fiscal note in this bill, and it turns out that we, missed that, including in packets, and my apologies for that. I guess that was an oversight. I wonder if we could maybe we should do is have it, we can get it printed. We're going to be here for a little while, I'm afraid, everybody. So it seems like as long as we're having the discussion, it might as well be worth it for us to see that. And so if I can ask staff to work on that. I'm going to just ask a question, and we'll perhaps just bring Representative Coulter back up, or we'll figure that out. We'll get out to people. The question, how did you choose the dollar amounts in the bill? These, you know, the $75 to $98, I assume there must be some reason to choose those amounts. Representative Coulter or Ms. Webster?
I think I'm going to have to tap out on that one.
Okay. Ms. Webster?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Coulter. I believe when we looked at, because there had not been an increase in a decade, trying to look at what might the reimbursement rates need to be to get closer to covering the actual costs that school districts expend for this service.
Okay. And so you, just to get closer to it, you're saying. Okay. I know that the governor's budget has this proposal in it. I don't know, and I don't know if Ms. Bickel knows offhand how closely this matches the governor's proposal in this area. If you don't know offhand, that's just fine. And maybe I'm wrong that it's in the governor. I thought that it was, but we're not so sure, huh? We can get back in. We can maybe connect back on that when we get the fiscal note too. And should we do that? Okay, we'll do a little bit of sleuthing. Get back to us on that. Okay. So anything else from any other members? Representative Coulter, you get the closing word for now. But again, we may end up we'll at least get the fiscal note out to folks. Depending on how things go, and we may just bring this back up to at least sort of close the loop on it. But for now, Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, Representative Hudson, yeah. I feel like you just gave me the title of my parenting memoir, No Frame of Reference. you know, I think, as has been spoken here tonight, I think we all know the value of this program. And given the amount of time that we spent in this committee talking about the importance of caring for our youngest Minnesotans, I'm not going to spend so much time on that. You know, I guess I would just say again that to me this kind of feels like the definition of unfunded mandate. And to put this in some perspective, the last time this aid was increased was less than a week after I graduated from college. This is an important service, and if we're going to tell our districts that they have to do it, I think we should just do a better job of covering the costs. So thank you.
Thank you so much. And thank you, Ms. Webster, for bringing this to us. With that, the chair lays over House File 993, and I'm hoping that we can even bring it back up a little bit later just to finish up the discussion with the fiscal note in front of us. And Representative Coulter, we're going to keep you up there, and you are moving House File 2330 to bring that before the committee.
That is my motion.
Okay. And there is an A2 amendment that was submitted to us after our committee deadline, and so we're going to be having it for discussion only, so we're not going to move on that amendment at this point. No problem on that. And so we will have you, Representative Coulter, please describe the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, if the last bill was merely changing some numbers, this is a little bit more than that. To the chair's point, we're not going to be taking action on the amendment. Most of it is fairly technical. There are two pieces I would say that are a little bit more than that I will mention as I walk through the bill, just so that folks are aware. So House File 2330 is a policy bill brought forward by the Department of Human Services Office of the Inspector General. This bill specifically deals with our committee's jurisdiction, and with the exception of one section, it's almost exclusively, I think, maybe more than one section, about child care licensing. Obviously, the bill, as I mentioned, is significant. I think it's close to 40 pages plus 4 pages of repealers. So I think, and going section by section would probably be a little bit disjointed. So what I'd like to do is sort of walk through the bill in sort of broader strokes, and then Autumn Baum with DHS can fill in the gaps that the committee may want more specificity on. The first topic that I will speak to is how the bill addresses safety with regards to child foster care. Sections 3 through 6 and 11 clarify that license holders must be able to continue to safely care for a child in order to maintain their license. Additionally, license holders would be required to notify their licensing agency if there are changes to their mental or physical health that would impact their ability to care or pose a risk to the child's health, or if the child is removed from their home. It does also state that the licensing agency may request evaluations of mental and physical health in order to confirm the license holder's ability to care. And that piece, let me pull up the A2 here quickly. The A2 does add to that a little bit by saying that prior to assigning a specialist to evaluate, the agency must tell the license holder why they are requesting that. So moving on then, sections 13, 21, 22, and 34 consolidate training requirements for licensed foster care providers into one new section of statute. But the language in the new section is the same as currently exists. And this was a recommendation for ease and accessibility from the child foster care work group that the commissioner established in 2015. Sections 2 and 29 are both clarifying language around child care license and non-licensed provider certification reviews, replacing the phrase at least annually with at least once each calendar year, and this aligns with current practice. Sections 8 through 10 all relate to safe sleeping. Specifically, these sections state that pacifiers must not be attached to clothing or have other attachments, and that sleepwear should not be weighted. They also provide greater clarity on prohibited types of sleepwear and the conditions under which infants may wear helmets, basically if they are prescribed by relevant professionals. These sections also remove outdated language, clarify the definition of swaddle in plain language, and allow for variances for cradle boards for cultural accommodation. And the second sort of less technical piece to the amendment is adding a definition of cradle board, that was, I believe, derived with consultation with our tribal partners. I thought I saw Representative Keeler's ears perk up when I mentioned that. So sections 14, 23, and 27 require more types of programs that serve children to complete training on maltreatment, and also specify that the training must be completed initially and on a yearly basis. Sections 28 and 30 through 33 all address license-exempt certified child care centers. This bill would allow them to serve children age 14 or older if they continue to be eligible for CCAP or if the center serves only students in eighth grade or below. It also makes various changes with regards to DHS notification and administration of non-prescription medications. Sections 7 and 15 through 20 are all just codification of current applicable fire code standards, and Section 34 repeals related rules that are just obsolete. Section 12 requires all family child care licensors to use the state electronic licensing inspection checklist information during licensing reviews or investigations for the purpose of standardizing the format in which that information is conveyed.
Representative Holder, I'm just going to pause you. Are you almost done?
I'm literally on the last.
I think the jump from section 34 to section 12 kind of sent my head spinning a little bit. So
that's also why I chose not to do that section by section, because it felt like a thematic approach was the better one there. So the final piece, sections 1, 25, and 26 all relate to the child care assistance program. Specifically, a reconsideration process is established for correction orders if the provider believes there are errors. And the bill also adds protections for individuals who report suspected fraud in good faith to ensure that their names are kept confidential. That was a lot of information in a very short amount of time, so that's why we have folks here who can speak to it much more expertly than I can. But that is the essence of the
bill. No problem. Thank you, Representative Holder. And I'll just say for members, we both budgeted somewhat more time for this bill, of course, and it's also being laid over, so we've got a chance to kind of dive in. I was reviewing it earlier, and there's a fair amount here. Ms. Baum, were you going to be speaking to the bill, just here for questions? If you're speaking to it, then please identify yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, I'm just here for questions.
Okay. Yeah, please identify yourself, though, I guess, as long as I called in you at all for that.
My apologies. Yeah. Mr. Chair, I am Autumn Baum. I am the Legislative Director for the Office of Inspector General at the Department of Human Services.
Okay, thank you. Let me think. Let's do this first to see if there's any member of the public who wishes to testify. Ms. Cunningham, come on down. Yeah. Make some space for if you can.
Come down.
Yeah, that's all good, yeah. Welcome back, and please, you identified yourself before, but please proceed. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I'm Cindy Cunningham. I'm a licensed family child care provider in St. Paul of 26 years. I'm the public policy chairperson for the State Association, NICPIN. We are the 501c3 statewide association specifically for licensed child care. So I will specifically address the reduction of safe sleep or of infant death, and also the ELISI tool. So we're thrilled to have this information and this legislation brought forward. I was the main testifier over 10 years ago when this was first an issue. I was known to bring swaddle sacks to to legislative hearings, because at that point in time, 10 years ago, no one knew what a swaddle sack was and the tool and how it was used. What this bill brings...
legislators who could use some.
I know. I think you asked me, do we have to have this again, Cindy? So, it's okay. But if I were to do that now, there are so many products and so many opportunities and so many choices for families and for providers in our settings that I would not be able to bring them all here. This bill has come about from work from myself and McPenn a number of years ago, approximately 3 years ago. The legislation had DHS put together a working group to work together. So this is the product of many stakeholders, centers, family child care. I'm not even sure who else, because it's been a while. I'm looking over at Mr. Ash. So it was hard work. It was hard investment. And we finished our work, and it's just really good to see it at this point. Clear expectations lead to compliance and consistency, both by the provider and the licensor. Currently, this is not in place, and therefore providers are uncertain of some specific expectations. And also licensors do not implement on a consistent basis. These changes will bring legislation up to date for everyone's benefit, in particular the children in our care. In addition to these changes, we would like to point out a few aspects that are not specific in the bill, but we want to address. One is that DHS needs to make sure that this training is updated for family child care providers. Those trainings are not consistently updated annually to be in alignment with the legislation.
Ms. Cunningham, are you saying these are pieces that are not in the bill?
Not specifically worded out, and you're not going to.
Would you mind sending them? I'm concerned.
I can send them to you. Yes.
If you could, yep. Yeah. If there are things not in the bill, then maybe that's something you can.
Yes.
If
I've attempted to bring these up at other times and in other ways with legislation, so I can be glad to set this one to it. We're asking that there's consistency in how safe sleep practices are implemented at all child care settings. Currently, that is not the case. Regarding the LISI tool, that seems like a small thing to have licensors.
Ms. Cunningham, pardon me, so are these things in the bill?
The LISI tool is in the bill. Okay. Sorry, thank you. Appreciate that. The LISI tool, the electronic system that licensors have available that this legislation brings into what I read as a mandate that they're required to use, is a tool that is powerful both for the licensor and for the provider to both have adequate and equal information. And when a licensor comes into the home and does not have the LISI tool to compare where correction orders are, they go back to their office. They get to make a decision about whether a situation is a violation or not, and then they issue the correction order. It precludes the situation that providers are given the opportunity for an exit interview before the licensor leaves, and therefore then they can dispute the correction order in their home before they leave. If the licensor does not have the LISI tool in their hands, then they go back to the office, and that step is taken out of the hands of the provider. So this is a really critical tool that needs to be in place, that it is required. I work with providers, have a couple right now, and that what the description of what I just said is happening, and they cannot dispute before it's written up as a correction order. They can only do it afterwards.
Thank you so much. Thanks for your work.
Thank you.
Member questions, and I know the, and again, we've got a bit of time if folks feel the need for additional detail on some of the components of the bill, but we'll go to Representative Hicks and then go on from there. Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Coulter. You may need to phone a friend for this one.
Could I ask you quickly to pull the mic just a little bit closer?
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know if you'll need to phone a friend, but on line 4.7, where it says, for a family foster setting, has or has an individual been living in the household where licensed services are provided or has otherwise subject to a background study? So we've talked about background studies in other committees, too. So I just want to clarify, would this be anybody over the age of what?
Let's get, Ms. Baum, please, if you're the right person. Or... somebody else?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I may call on my staff if they know the answer to this question. Otherwise, I can take it back to our background studies folks. We have folks here from licensing and our program integrity area. But
yep. Let's see. So we have somebody who can help answer Representative Hicks's question.
Do you have it?
Yay.
Okay. All right. Well,
sure.
Josh, welcome, and please, once you get settled in, please identify yourself and then proceed.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hicks, I'm Larry Hosh. I am the manager of in the licensing division. The changes, Representative Hicks, that you reference are technical corrections. They were omissions that were not referenced in previous background study law changes. So this just makes sure that the subdivision that was omitted in previous action is added in. So this is generally a technical change.
I think the question is the person referenced the individual living in the household? Would that be an adult, or could it be any person? Representative Hicks, I don't want to put words in your mouth. Is that what you're asking, Representative Hicks? Yeah. So, Mr. Hosh, do you know?
So I'll tell you what my underlying question is.
Representative Hicks.
Because this happens to foster families a lot. So we are foster families, and then we stop being foster families because the 15-year-old that's in our home has been adopted. But the 15-year-old that's in our home that's been adopted has a juvenile justice crime on their record. And so would a child care provider who adopts a 15-year-old who they were fostering, who has committed a crime, lose their license because their 15-year-old that they adopted has a juvenile record? That is my question.
Ms. Josh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hicks, I would have to get back to you on that question. This change does not change any current requirements, and this is just a technical fix for the background studies reform that was done few years ago. So the specificity to your question, I can get back to you. But this change in House File 2330 does not change any current practice.
And please do get back to us. And I'm just going to add, and if you could, I guess I'd be interested to know where the current law is that this is just a technical fix for, because this language does appear multiple times in the sections of the bill, which makes me sort of wonder about that. But Representative Hicks, back to you.
Yes, thank you, Chair. And so maybe there's a broader problem that I'm not aware of. Or maybe that I am kind of preferentially aware of, but that's my only concern is I don't want people to keep their whole livelihood to be punished by a choice of a teenager.
Looking at the bill beforehand, given a note to Representative Coulter, wondering about this series of provisions that Representative Hicks is asking about. And so I guess definitely would want more information from the department about kind of what the implication would be, and also sort of how it's a technical fix, because I guess I'm confused if it's, you know, how all that works. If you can make sure to get back to us, that'd be great. I'm good. Okay, good. Questions, discussions, discussion points, members? Well, Representative Lesnikar, pardon me. I keep missing you. I'm so sorry.
That's okay. Thank you, Chair Pinto. And thank you, Representative. My questions are, I have a few of them. On the sense, there's a part, let me get to it here, on when a baby falls asleep. And I ask this because I've visited childcare settings and home care providers, and I hear from people that it's very challenging if you have a baby falling asleep, and it there has to be discretion. You're on a walk, and you have children in a stroller, and you have various ages, one falls asleep that you're holding. I don't know if it's in a front pack or whatever it could be. But then the rules read that you should lay the baby down in the crib as soon as possible, which has to be judgment, because if you're on a walk, you're outside. And not only that, but when I ask the teachers and the providers, there's some children that, you know, may be asthmatic, may have a lot of different, they have different needs, every kid does. And some of them said, look, there are times when that child just needs to be held. And the minute you place that baby down, it's just crying. It's a continual pattern. And I can understand that, being a mom with two different kids in those early ages, how challenging it'd be. I mean, I went in the crib room and I watched, and I asked, how in the world do you ever get six of these children this age to sleep? They can't have their pacifier. They can't have a blanket. They can't be held. Some of them don't, you know, some of them have, they have all different, I worry about the emotional need of the child too, as much as being able to sleep. When you're sleep deprived, you're not going to do well as a young child. Mine would go into more asthma attacks when he was,
you know, distressed as a young child. So I just wish there was more flexibility for center daycare providers and home providers, because I heard it from all of them. I would like your feedback on that question before I ask the second one, because I just think it's an important thing for young, especially young children, to be able to be held.
Mr. Rosh, if you're the right person, or?
I can do my best. Okay. I've got phone a friend on my computer as well with people responding. Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Zalesnikar, the hypothetical you provided with a baby falling asleep while on the walk, as soon as practicable, that would not require them to end the walk and put the child to bed right away. You can finish the walk. You can meet those individual circumstances. I, too, like yourself, I have 3 children at home, family child care, and I can't imagine how you can balance putting 6 kids to sleep. But we aren't so strict where you have to end the walk in your hypothetical and put that child to sleep.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Chair Pinto, well, a lot has changed since I had young children. The rules have changed significantly, and I just think about what I would have done for child care with an asthmatic kid who was allowed to sleep on the couch, propped up at the home daycare, because that's how he slept best. He was never laid in a crib, and I would have never had child care for that child to be able to go to work. And I can't imagine there aren't other people that have children that don't fit the perfect box. And I had one that did and one that didn't, but I was grateful that the provider had enough common sense to be able to do that, and the rules allowed for it. And it saddens me to think that that's not the case now, because a child like that, whether it's autism or, you know, medical issues, he was children that are born early, they're developmentally delayed, and they need something different. And so to treat them all the same and not have the provider have enough ability to make a decision like a parent would, they're acting as I would. I held him in a pack walking around the house, and he was sleeping. So I just think there should be more judgment allowed. It could be right in the center, and 4 are sleeping, and 1 sleeping with you. But if that's what the person thinks is best, you can feel them breathing when they're with you. So I just think it should be something. And the second part was on the count of 14. When I've talked to home daycare providers, it's my understanding that the children of the parent are counted in that count. So if you have 2 children and you have 14 allowed in a home center, you have to deduct your own children, so you can have 12 then. Is that correct?
Mr. Osh.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zalesnikar, for some of the situations like having a pacifier, being able to be held while sleeping, you can absolutely do that right now. The safe sleep recommendations are from the American Association of Pediatrics. They've had 2 updates in their recommendations since we've been able to update our safe sleep standards. The work group was put together with a broad swath of stakeholders that support this legislation. On the limits and ratios for family child care centers, this bill does not affect or change any of those limits. So that I think is a discussion for another point. But on the safe sleep standards themselves, the hypotheticals that you presented can occur. Depending on the situation, and a child can be held, a child can have a pacifier, just can't be attached, and this follows, a large group of consensus with the American Association of Pediatrics and their recommendations.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. I think in talking to providers, it depends on who surveyed them when they've come into their setting on what is the subjectiveness. And so, you know, that ability to make that decision, that scope between licensing has not all been consistently the same. That's my only feedback that I hear from people in my district. And I'm just concerned when we have 700 less family child care providers, how we do the count and whether it's appropriate at this committee or not. If you have 2 children and you can only provide for 12, it's for many of these people, it's not cost prohibitive to be able to do home-based child care. And that's where many of the people have said they've closed their home daycare and they have went to work for a center because their kids aren't counted in the count if they work for a center. So I think it's something we need to know. Thank you.
Yeah, we may be getting a little bit beyond the scope of this particular bill, but certainly ongoing conversations. Other member questions or discussion? Vice Chair Keeler.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. Thank you, Representative, for this. Okay, I am going to make a statement that's probably not... I just feel like I need to stay it on record that this gets really frustrating. So really little things will remove children from a family. On line 7.29, it talks about that if a license holder is responsible and is in the result is a serious maltreatment, it's only a fine of $5,000. So I think it's really frustrating that, like, things that centers can get away with and just be fined are actually reasons why children are being taken out of homes in the child welfare system. So I just need that to be on record. I think that that's really complicated, and that's not safe or not fair. What I do have a question about is you addressed some changes on the medications that children can have, adding non-prescription medication. The one piece about it that I feel like is not addressed, and now we're on, like, 40.8 through 40.20, is there's nothing in here requiring that the medication has to be in the right temperature control. It just says it has to be in the right container, the child's name, not expired. Is there a reason why we're not adding the accurate temperature control? Because I have a child that needs to take a medicine that's refrigerated. So can you answer why that's not in there, or if that's something that maybe we just overlooked and needs to be in there?
I personally can't answer that particular question.
Let's just go to your testifier, Mr. Hodge.
Somebody could.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this particular provision just aligns with what we do for licensed except certified centers, along with aligns with what we do for child care centers and family child care. The specificity on the temperature control, I would have to get a better answer than what I could answer for you now, if that was an omission or if that's a standard that we have on our regular inspection visits.
This is helpful. As I'm understanding, because I had been curious about this before. So you're saying that the language here in this section 32 makes license exempt centers be have the same requirements as family child care and child care centers. Is that right, Mr. Hosh?
Mr. Chair, correct. This applies to license-exempt child care, license-exempt certified centers. We do this practice already for child care centers and family child care. And for the question on, like, the temperature, the provider is required to follow the instructions on the label. So if the label says that they must be stored in a certain temperature, that would be a requirement.
Vice Chair Keeler.
I still have concerns. We can follow up offline about it. Thank you.
But thank you for raising that. And actually, I had been wondering about that section, so I appreciate you clarifying that, Mr. Hosh. Other questions, discussions for members? So seeing none, sounds like so continued conversation. I should maybe note that there's this bill's being laid over. We had a couple of other child care regulation bills that were laid over. It's possible that we may bring one or more of them back up before we would do a budget bill. I'm still kind of looking at that. If I will just urge members of the public, if you have comments, input on what is in this bill or the other bills that we've heard, we certainly want to hear that. And we may well be bringing things back up. Representative Coulter, though, you get the final word.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Obviously this bill is being laid over. This is not our only bite at the apple, so to speak. And I did also want to mention, I know it's been a topic of interest in this committee that I believe Chair Knorr is also working on some child care assistance program integrity measures. And so I'm sure folks will be interested in that as well. I guess just sort of, you know, in closing, I know I'm usually not comfortable speaking for other people, but in this case, I'm going to go out on a limb and suggest that the department is also perfectly willing to continue the conversation on ways to make this better, on ways to address concerns that have come up through the process. So I will add that everything in the bill has been approved by relevant stakeholders, but that should obviously not be the end of the conversation. So thank you for your time and the thoughtful discussion.
Thank you so much. So with that, the chair lays over House Bill 2330. We did not amend it, though we had an amendment in our hands. And laying that over for possible inclusion in a budget bill or for otherwise coming back up. So thank you so much. Members, we do have the physical copies. Actually, Representative Katiza-Witun, we have the physical copies of the fiscal note. So Representative Coulter, I'm inclined, while that's relatively fresh, just knock that out. Representative Katiza-Witun.
I'm in committee.
Oh, you're in committee on commerce right now? Okay, let's get you on up then.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, come on up. So Representative Katiza Watoon moves House File 2573 to bring that before the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is my motion.
Okay. And then the A1 amendment, Representative Katiza Watoon, you'd like to move that?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And that amendment, Representative Katiza Watoon, it looks like it's pretty technical, inserting an amount of amounts of money.
Yes, Mr. Chair. We were removing language that was in your bill, the Great Start bill, so there's no duplicity. And then it incorporates some TA from DHS as well as fills in the blank appropriation.
Great. So any comments or questions regarding the A1 amendment? So all those in favor of Representative Katiza Watoon's motion to move the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay. Motion passes. The bill's amended. Representative Katiza Watoon, present your bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, so far this session in this committee, we have heard much discussion of the crisis that our state is facing in child care. Slots are often not available, the price for families is often much too high, and across the board, we are paying early childhood educators a dismal compensation rate, lower than even that of dog walkers. Higher education institutions are reporting having issues recruiting and retaining candidates for their early childhood programs. The candidates who pursue early childhood education face difficulties finding apprenticeship opportunities because, frankly, there aren't many places that can offer a program that's financially viable when most places are struggling just to keep the doors open. We know that the first 5 years of a child's life are absolutely vital to shaping who they will become, and it's important for the adults caring for our littles to be well-trained, qualified individuals with the right tools to help our kids thrive. This sector has struggled too long, and we have the opportunity right now to help us recruit more folks to the profession and professionalize and better compensate the workforce behind everyone else's workforce. We've already heard the Great Start bill in this committee, and we'll continue to discuss our own proposals as well as the governor's recommendation to help uplift our community of early childhood educators. House File 2573 is an important piece of that discussion. I have Ann McCulley from Transforming Minnesota's Early Childhood Workforce today to explain how this bill fits into the bigger picture, and also Hope Derner, an early childhood education faculty member at Minneapolis Community Technical College, to illustrate how this bill will impact our early childhood workforce.
Thank you so much, Representative Katiza Watoon. And Ms. McCulley, thank you for all of your work and for being here. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Pinto. Good evening, everyone. My name is Ann McCulley, as said, and I am here in my capacity as co-chair of Transforming Minnesota's Early Childhood Workforce team. The early care and education workforce serves children, families, businesses, and our entire economy. Transforming Minnesota's Early Childhood Workforce team was formed in 2016 to build on the recommendations of the Transforming the Workforce for Children Birth Through Age 8 report from the National Institute of Medicine. We want to ensure that Minnesota's early educators are qualified, diverse, supported, and equitably compensated, regardless of setting. There's a graphic, and I know you have a plethora of handouts tonight, but you will see a graphic that talks about some of the work we have tried to do collectively and now is reflected in a number of vehicles. Looks like a mountain. And it talks about efforts, particularly around efforts to address compensation for our workforce. Many of the precursor ideas of transforming the workforce show up in the Great Start for All Minnesota Children report, and many of us served on that task force. And so, again, as Representative Katiza Watoon mentioned, there is one other handout that does sort of try to lay out for you how these nest together. There's a vision page, and basically what I want to make clear is there are many, many strategies involved with trying to support our early childhood workforce. Some of them are in that Great Start Act of 2023 bill you heard last week. Many will be in the governor's bill, which I believe you'll be hearing this week. So this bill kind of looks at all of those and said, here's a few more strategies in particular that relate also to higher ed, where we know we can either increase access to higher education for our early educators who want to take that path, and how we can better align our higher ed and our early education systems. So I'm here for questions at the end and more conversation as needed, but I'd really like to give the bulk of my time to Hope Derner. So I'm going to step aside.
Okay, great. Thank you. Please, once you get a chance to settle in, identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chairman, representatives. My name is Hope Derner. I'm a faculty at Minneapolis College in the Early Childhood Education Department. I'm here today to share with you the need for continued and increased support for the early childhood education profession. As a person with over 35 years of experience in the field, I can honestly say that the need for support has never been so great as it is today. I see on a daily basis students at my college wanting to improve their skills with children and improve their practices, but are struggling financially to make ends meet. This bill allows for the continuation of support for those who are currently in the field seeking college credentials, as well as encouraging more to join the field in the Empower to Educate or the new apprenticeship program. The Teach Early Childhood Scholarships are truly the only way that many of my students can afford to get a college education. This opportunity allows the students to have at least 90% of their costs covered by the scholarships and support from their program. The scholarship allows them to have all of their expenses covered, tuitions, fees, books, computers, etc. This allows students to stay debt-free in an industry that is vital to the overall economic success of our state, while not always providing them with the wages that they deserve. I will say that most of my students are currently working in the field and are looking to improve their practice and opportunities for their long-term careers by gaining a college degree. What has been helpful is the addition of the early childhood education programs to the Workforce Development Scholarship Fund. This funding can be used alone or in addition to the Teach Early Childhood Scholarship, which they then can use to help with other costs like transportation and cost of living expenses. The difficulty some students face is the competition for the Workforce Development Scholarships. The reason for the lower percentage of students in the early childhood education field accessing these scholarships can vary from campus to campus. We know that the state does not have enough spaces available for all of the children whose families want to work. Some early childhood programs servicing families have closed, and others do not have enough workers to fill the remaining open positions that they have to meet the need. It is time to look at carving out a set amount of money specifically for the early childhood education programs within the Workforce Development Scholarship to help alleviate this shortage. This dedicated funding can also help campuses market specifically to encourage more students into the field of early childhood education, benefiting not just those students or programs or families, but the state as a whole. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us and for your work. We have, I know, at least one public testifier signed up in advance. Cindy Cunningham, please make your way on up. And once you settle in, please proceed with your testimony.
Good evening. Cindy Cunningham, Family Child Care Provider in St. Paul, the Family Child Care State Association Public Policy Chairperson. One, I want to make sure to make a note of a lot of what has gone on as you all show up frequently, consistently, to work on behalf of all of these things. I will say as a public person, I keep track of this. I also work. And it's been very difficult to keep up with every single piece of the bills. I can't imagine what it's like here, but I want you to understand that keeping track of it and being able to speak to it from a knowledgeable standpoint has been very difficult. I very much am appreciative of the evening hearing so that I have the opportunity to come. The virtual is missed. So here's my little commentary of things. I have had the privilege of being in the Great Start Task Force, I showed up once a month to the meetings. I showed up once a month to additional compensation meetings to discuss all of these details. I've attempted between the task force closure and this bill introductions to be in discussion with those moving bills forward amongst other bills that are moving forward for the Great Start. I've basically been met with silence and non-engagement in conversation. Hence, I'm bringing forth some family child care perspective directly to you, hoping for something more than the silence. The early childhood apprenticeship program is something that, in general, we support the efforts because family child care is included. We have family child care providers who have participated in similar programs, and the ability to educate on the high value and opportunities with our industry is welcomed. We have concerns about others in the system who do not value family child care, and actually whether they will actually utilize family child care settings for these kinds of programs. There is an ongoing experience of family child care providers who enter higher education where they are not valued by the higher education setting, and they have been discredited and have heard higher education staff dissuade individuals from going into family child care. if this continues, this will not benefit the overall industry. We are aware of, there is a similar, excuse me, it's not my pattern to try to speak negatively about things. This is difficult. There is childcare where it is moving forward with an apprenticeship program, and I know the reasonings behind it, but there is family childcare is not included, is in the centers are included. There's barriers that are for this. But to us as a view for family childcare, this is a consistent and a persistent approach. We are second. We are not understood. Centers are understandable. Staff at centers are understandable. We value centers, but to the point where family childcare is diminished, is an ongoing experience. The competencies task force, it became clear that this difference
was cutting of that section was deleted out of the bill.
Okay, is that being put back in the House Great Start piece that was heard last week?
It's our budget bill, if it, I mean, has not been prepared to the point, so that's not in front of us.
Will there be an opportunity to speak to it another time?
If it comes back up, there certainly will be. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm good. Thank you for your work. So members, any other members of the public, I should ask that first, who wish to speak? I don't see any. And so we'll move to member discussions and questions. All Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'll just say I like the idea of an apprenticeship program. Apprenticing is some wisdom from our elders, past generations, that I think has fallen out of practice in a lot of sectors of the economy, and reintroducing it as an idea is, I think, a step in the right direction. I'm curious about this, and I'm going to have to turn the page to remember it exactly. Recognizing comparable competencies to achieve comparable compensation task force.
And so as part that was taken out of the bill, Representative Hudson just...
Oh, it was taken out.
That was... at least I'll maybe confirm... that section is no longer in the bill.
All right, then I have no questions.
Oh, well, there you go. That simplifies life. There we go. Okay. Other member questions or discussion? I'm sorry, Representative Nelson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question I have is, what is the kind of the, maybe there's a definition of what an apprenticeship is for a length of time. Is this a semester? Is it a... In a year, you know, just kind of wondering what the scope of this entails.
And Ms. McCauley.
Yes, hi. Sorry, it's really hard to see everyone. Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson. So this is a good chance for me to elaborate on the fact that we are working right now with a model that's out of the National Teach Center. So Teach is the early learning scholarship that Hope Joyner just mentioned, that's also in the governor's bill. It's been around for about 20 years as a straightforward scholarship for people who are already working in early childhood who want to go back and get their degree. What they've developed is a model that will supplement with that. Actually, it will meet the National Department of Labor and Industry guidelines. And what we're working on in Minnesota is to further make it meet Minnesota's guidelines. So Department of Labor and Industry, Department of Human Services, our office that works on Teach are all working together on launching a short pilot in June of an apprenticeship. And then what this bill is doing is hoping to grow that funding, because that funding will end, and build a longer apprenticeship. To your point, there are probably others who understand apprenticeships even better than I've had the crash course of, but the main issue is it involves on-the-job training, which in our version would be you're working in a child care center or family child care home, and we are working on a model for family child care homes. You receive support in the form of a mentor, so somebody who can be there with you and help you guide your way, and then you receive college training, and that's where we're blending it with the current Teach scholarship. So that allows you to go back to school. One of the amendments tonight was to take out reference to an associate's degree, so it could also be a bachelor's degree or even more. And I believe what we're working on right now is an up to 24-month option, particularly if somebody's going to pursue an AA or a BA degree, where they can be working across time on their apprenticeship. So it's trying to take the sort of typical registered apprenticeship model that exists in a lot of other industries and make it fit with childcare. The other quick big difference, as you'll see, is there's money there for the actual sponsoring agency, meaning the childcare program. There's money for a mentor, and there's, of course, the money for the college scholarship. Because childcare, as you all have heard, tends to not have a lot of cash in order to buy into something like an apprenticeship. This model would offer that sort of sponsorship to help our child care programs engage in the apprenticeship model.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you for that. I think that helps, kind of understanding all what is entailed in that. And I agree, as Representative Hudson said, the apprenticeship model is, I think, in many ways something that works. And we often see it in the construction trade and things like that. And I think oftentimes, there's generational wisdom to pass down of just experience that you don't always get from a book, from a classroom. And I appreciate that. And I think that's working in a good direction.
Ms. McCulley, Representative Batoon, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, and I do want to add, it's not in regards to the timeline of the apprenticeship definition, but I do want to add that I am in conversations with the Department of Labor and Industry, and they have been working to frame up a very similar type program. So we are going to have ongoing discussions with DLI and DHS to see if it makes sense to layer this on top of the prep work that they've been doing for the last year. They're hopeful to kick off that child care related apprenticeship program as of September 1. So we will, I'll report back to the committee with additional details.
Thank you. Members, other questions or discussions on the bill? Vice Chair Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. I should not have grabbed a red pen because for some reason it feels like I just need to mark up these bills with a ton of questions. So also sorry if I go to a part that's been removed. But so we're not doing the task force. Is that right? That whole part is.
That section's been removed in the amendment. Yep.
So one of my questions is 1.23, you have to be 18 years or have a high school diploma. Would that include a GED? Because I know that there are some spaces that, for employment purposes, a GED doesn't always show up as an equivalent to a high school diploma. So could you clarify that first?
Ms. McCulley, I suspect the goal would be to have it, but Ms. McCulley?
Mr. Chair, Representative Keeler, I sit here not completely sure. I think this is one of what a lot of this mirrors is what we're being told needs to go into a typical apprenticeship model. So I think I'd have to find out if that is an option and let you know.
If we could definitely look, maybe I'll ask Ms. Mock, if you could just keep an eye. I don't know if you have an answer now, but otherwise if you could look into this point. So, okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative.
I just want to say in general that's something that I would be supportive of.
Yeah, I would think.
If it follows other requirements.
Good. And Vice, let's see, something else, Ms. McCall? No? Okay, so Vice Chair Keeler back.
Hope is saying that colleges do have, pardon me, Mr. Chair, that colleges do have GED or. So it may very well be. It's just not explicitly stated here. So we will find out for you.
We're going to have Ms. Mock make sure. And so if this does advance, to make sure that language does include, it sounds like the bill's author is okay with that, to have that, be sure it does include it. But Vice Chair Keeler.
Yeah, thank you. I figured it would. In my time in higher ed, this was a big conversation and making sure that that is really detailed in there because we've seen that used, like, against some people who've gone back for GEDs. The workforce development scholarships, that is still in, so 5.25, mm-hmm. Right?
That is in the bill.
Okay.
Only long at home, yes.
So I have some questions. So again, I used to sit on higher education, and this was something that I really believe in. But my question is about the ask in the funding. And so when I just asked the chair, this is not going to higher education, correct?
Representative Cattese-Batoon or Ms. McCulley? Representative Cattese-Batoon.
Mr. Chair and Vice Chair Keeler, yes, that is correct.
Okay.
I think that Chair Pulowski has waived hearing this. Vice Chair Keeler.
I just wanted to make sure, so I'm going to ask some questions with that hat on, knowing that it's not going there, because I do have some questions. So is there any data that shows the engaged interest of individuals wanting to go into the early childhood? Because mathematically, when you look at the statute around this, it says that each individual only gets $2,500 for two terms. That's what the statute says. So then that's telling us that we're asking for funding to offset 100 students 1 year and 100 students the next year. So I'm just wondering, what data do you have from a higher ed lens that says we have people in Minnesota, 200 individuals in Minnesota that would do this, or is this just a goal?
Ms. Durner, I think I'm saying your last name correctly.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. So I can speak to my program alone at Minneapolis College. In the fall, we had 23 applicants just at our college alone for this scholarship. And there are, I do believe, 22 programs in the state in early ed. I'd have to double check that number. So not every program is going to be as large as ours. And what I haven't been able to do is for some students, if the money runs out at a college, because each college is allocated a set amount of workforce development funds that goes to all of the different programs within that funding category. And as soon as, and depending on the college, and this is where it varies, sometimes it's a first come, first serve. And if you've got, a nursing program or a technical program that also fits this category, we may not get those students as quickly in the queue to be able to honor that potential commitment of cash. And so having this allocated separately, knowing that we can then market to the students saying, we have this money to make you in this industry that doesn't make as much as some of the others that are in the Workforce Development Fund, say you can go to school and get your degree, and it's not going to be a burden on you for loans and debt at the end.
Vice Chair Keeler.
Okay. Yes, all of that, right? We know that. But the problem with the workforce development scholarships is that it is expanding. We know that this year that the ask is adding it's police, force, education, and construction already to the seven programs that are already listed under here. They already have a $9 million base, and they're asking for 25.5 additional. So I'm worried that adding the funding into this component is maybe not the best, because it is so broad. That if we want the money to go directly in to future child care professionals, that the Workforce Development Fund in higher ed is growing to a lot of different areas. And I just want to express the nervousness I have for that to be the vehicle to fund what we're doing, because I agree. I mean, I would love for this to even say that high school students could get credit, because I know that we're talking about that in spaces too. I just want to caution us that I know that this looks like a really good idea, but working in partnership with higher ed and the fact that it's not going there, I just think we maybe need to think outside the box a little bit for a long-term sustainable funding program for this. I'm sorry, I just needed to make sure that we had that under that we actually talked about that. And with that, I know that we don't want to add more stops, and I know that the chair waived it, but I do think because of that, I would just encourage us to maybe think about having a conversation in higher ed around that as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Vice Chair Keeler. Representative Cattis-Watoon, if you have anything to say. Or
yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to clarify, it's my understanding that this funding would be earmarked for early childhood programming. So I don't know if we need to double check the language, and I can work with Ms. Mock on that. But I do appreciate your statement there, and in your experience in higher ed, and I would be glad to tweak that as needed.
And I think it is dedicated, the language in the bill is dedicated exclusively to early childhood. So, but on ongoing conversation, you got something else you want
to? Yeah, I mean, I guess publicly, it's adding so much more work behind the scenes to earmark in a program that we're growing in a way that I just want us to be really cautious that in the front view of it, as we read it, it looks really great. Behind the scenes, and what the Office of Higher Education has to do for this, it may be more cumbersome than it is actually beneficial. But I would love to talk about it more. Thank you.
So we should probably move on, not seeing anybody else have their hands up. So Representative Cattis-Watoon, you get the last word on your bill and ongoing conversation clearly.
Please. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for this great discussion tonight. I'm happy to be back in Children and Families for a little while from my Commerce hearing, which is where Representative Davis was when he stepped out. So we switched places for a minute. I think that this bill is really critical as we look at expanding the workforce and just reaching additional people who have an interest in moving this path in their education and in their profession. I think it's knowing that at least right now the salaries are
untenably low for most people to be able to earn a living wage, and then kind of the additional hurdle of having to take on debt in order to gain a degree in this area, I think that gives a lot of people pause when they consider what they might want to do for their career. And so I appreciate the committee's consideration. I know that we'll have the opportunity to have an ongoing discussion about this and discussions behind the scenes, including DHS, the Department of Labor and Industry, as well as the Department of Higher Ed. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Cadiz-Witun, and thanks to Ms. Turner and to the folks who put this together. I know you've been working really hard on behalf of the early childhood workforce in our state, so thank you so much. So with that, the chair lays over House File 2573 as amended for possible inclusion in a budget bill. And so, Representative Hicks, you are up. House File 2665. Representative Hicks moves that bill for a possible inclusion, or moves it to bring it before the committee. And Representative Hicks, we've got an A1 amendment, and I am guessing that you would like that to be moved, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
That moved.
Okay. Representative Hicks moves the A1 amendment, which is quite a small technical amendment. Hopefully folks can read it and understand it. Are there questions or discussions to the motion, the A1 amendment? Oh, Representative Hudson, yeah, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know it's not common for amendments to attract discussion or questions, but I'm just curious what the purpose of eliminating 221 through 224 is. Is that because it's considered redundant to the lines that come before it, or is it just that the commissioner, we didn't want to burden the commissioner with having to prepare a report for the legislature, or what's the mechanism
there? I'm a little confused. Maybe I'm seeing the wrong amendment. You say 221.
Subdivision 6.
That's subdivision 6. I'm sorry. Yeah, okay. Representative Hicks. Thanks. Thanks, Representative Holder. So, Representative Hicks. Do you have any thoughts on that? It may be that we could defer. You maybe want to have a testifier or assist with that. Either way, Representative.
No. The reason we got rid of the reporting requirement was because we made it a competitive RFP, so there'll be ongoing reporting going into it. Oh. Having the department make somebody that they've already made report throughout the entire time report again is just a waste of state dollars. So that was the reason for that. Sorry.
Representative Hudson.
So redundancy. Got it. Thank you.
That's right. Thank you. Representative Colter. Okay, my goodness. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Lots of questions, too.
I'm a little bit confused why we're deleting lines, page 2, lines 11 through 13, because it also, the way I read this. And
so we just, on line 10, I'm sorry, Chair.
That's right.
On line 10, we changed it to purchase diapers and wipes and maybe use up to 4% of the cost to administer the grant. So we just condensed it down because we turned it. So the long and short of this is I have heard loud and clear from the GOP, from my colleagues on the other side, that they are not huge fans of direct appropriation grants. And so I took the bill and I made amendments to make it a competitive RFP. Like that was the goal here, was to make this competitive and open the dialogue to potentially others.
Good, Sam. And I'm grateful for that, too, I should say. I should maybe just say just generally that being able to move in a direction of rather than appropriating funds to individual organizations and instead saying having the agency have a competitive grant process, I just think is a better way in general for us to go. Not that that's going to be true in every case, but I do think, so appreciate that, Representative Hicks. I'm thinking we should get the bill in the form that she wishes, probably as a step here. No problem. Don't mind either members raising that. But unless there's further discussion to the A1 amendment, all in favor of getting the bill in the form that the author wishes by adopting the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Say thank you, members. So that motion passes. Representative Hicks, let's have you present your bill.
Thank you so much, Chair and members. And I do thank you for the discussion about the amendment, because I know it's a little bit different, but I took a previous bill and I tweaked it, and so my initial thought was, oh, no, I hope I didn't break that. But it does not appear that I did. So I really want to thank you for hearing it. Parents and young children are struggling with increased costs for housing and childcare, and many parents are struggling to afford diapers, and they end up stretching the time between changes because there is a cost associated. Diapers and wipes are not covered by WIC or SNAP, And so many times some of our lowest families are trying to get them from diaper banks. And they've been one of the really high demand baby items that we've seen. This bill establishes a diaper distribution program with appropriations in 24 and 25. Grants would be awarded to eligible applicants to provide diapers and wipes for families in need. Eligibility criteria would include having an established network for diaper distribution. So whoever's, as I stated before, this is the first time this would be competitive. So we had to list some eligibility criteria. We would want them to have a network for distribution, infrastructure for managing procurement, and relationships with national organizations who address diaper needs, and a commitment to working across the spectrum of ideas and political spectrums to really work with families. A commitment to working in a culturally sensitive ways, particularly in the areas of high poverty. I will let my testifiers speak to the broader concerns around diaper need in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you so much, Representative Hicks. And so if the testifiers can make your way on up, I guess the first one, Deirdre Conzer, and we'll have Michelle Winkleman be sort of on deck. Yeah, you can all sort of make your way up a little bit anyway, find a seat. And once you get settled in, identify yourself. Yep, come on down. And please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Deirdre Conzer, and I'm the Executive Director of the Diaper Bank of Minnesota. I do want to thank Representative Hicks for authoring this legislation, as well as you, Mr. Chair, and committee members for allowing me to share information with you about diaper need. According to the National Diaper Bank Network, one in three American families reports having an insufficient supply of diapers to keep an infant or child clean, dry, and healthy. To make ends meet, many parents reuse soiled diapers or use household items such as t-shirts, paper towels, or plastic bags to cover their baby's bottoms. Not surprisingly, this lack of clean diapers can lead to health risks for children, such as severe diaper rash and infections. Diaper need also impacts families' employment status and overall economic health. Limited diapers can impact access to childcare, as most, even free and subsidized facilities, require parents to provide an adequate supply of disposable diapers. Nationally, 57% of parents experiencing diaper need who rely on childcare said they missed an average of 4 days of school or work in the past month because they didn't have diapers. Currently, no state or federal child safety net programs allocate dollars specifically for the purchase of diapers. Meanwhile, a 2016 study found that providing diapers to families resulted in financial benefits related to health care, employment, and education. Overall, it found that personal income increases 11 times for every dollar invested in diaper assistance. The proposed state funding would significantly expand diaper access for families in need. It would support infant and toddler health, increase child care access, enable more parents to work, and increase families' economic well-being. Please support House File 2665 to ensure that every baby is clean, dry, and healthy. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'd be happy to answer any questions about diaper need or the Diaper Bank of Minnesota.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I know there's two other people signed up, and I'm sure they're just here for questions, though. Or are they going to be speaking? Yeah, sure. Come on up. Yeah, I might ask each if you can just do just a minute, please. Just get a little bit tight on time. But yeah, please identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Michelle Winkleman, and I sit on the board of the Diaper Bank of Minnesota as the treasurer. To begin with, thank you, Representative Hicks, for authoring this legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for your time. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. As I sit here today, I'm a successful professional and a breadwinner for a family of five. But let me take you back almost a couple of decades and what you would see as a young woman with a toddler and a baby, both girls and both in diapers. This young woman was making her way out of a bad situation and carved out her path forward with public assistance and the GI Bill in order to finish college and start a career. But in order to even start down this path, we had to have diapers. Access to diapers meant that my daughters could go to daycare so I could go to class. Diapers meant that my babies felt safe, secure, and loved as I was able to meet a critical basic hygiene need. And ultimately, access to diapers means that there are two young ladies who are lighting up the world today with their gifts. For 2023, the Diaper Bank of Minnesota received requests for 2.4 million diapers. These diaper requests represent approximately 40,000 children who all deserve the same care that I was able to provide my children. With an additional $500,000, we could have said yes to everybody and made inroads in the statewide diaper need, where it's estimated that there are approximately 90,000 children that need our help. In supporting our youngest Minnesotans, addressing diaper need is one of the most effective uses of funds in terms of clear, concrete impact in both the near term and the long term. Thank you again, Mr. Chair, committee members, for your time and attention and the opportunity to speak today. I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you so much.
Yes.
And then the final testifier is signed up, Shoshana Kraft. And please identify yourself, yeah, once you get settled in and proceed. Again, we've got probably just got a minute or so, I'm afraid. But, yeah, please.
Okay, thank you. Buju and Dinway Market and Nuke, Nino Kazi Kway, Indigenous Cause, Mokwet and Dodam, Gawababi Gani Kog and Dunjabug, Kabi Kong and Dad Nongum. Hello, my relatives. My name is Hummingbird Woman. Some people call me Shoshana Kraft. I work at the Division of Indian Work as a Director of Programs. I supervise many programs, including the Maternal Child Health Program, which include Women of Traditional Birthing, the NINDAY Doula Program, and the FASD Program as well. First of all, I want to say Migwich to Representative Hicks for authoring this bill, and we appreciate your hard work. Thank you, Mr. Chair and the committee, for being present and hearing our testimonies. Division of Indian Work is grateful for our partnership with the Diaper Bank of Minnesota. We have been partners for 6 years. Division of Indian Work supports and impacts families statewide. Our NINDAY Doula program assists our relatives as far away as Red Lake, Onamia, and Hastings, Minnesota. Our doulas travel to meet the needs of our pregnant and postpartum families. We provide baby bundles, baby supplies, and most importantly, clean new diapers for families. Our food pantry alone served over 9,000 individuals in 2022. Many of these same families who struggle to keep food on the table do not have the funds to buy diapers. The Diaper Bank of Minnesota provided 18,000 diapers and 37,000 wipes to Division of Indian Work in 2022. This was not enough to meet the critical hygiene needs for our families. We received donations from churches, individuals, and we purchased diapers to supplement the need. Many of our families live in rural Minnesota, where it is hard to make it to the next town. Many families have to make choices whether to buy diapers or to use other means. It is vital for our agencies such as ours to provide the basic needs, including diapers, to families. Mr. Chair and committee, with your help, and help is needed now, we can provide the much-needed clean diapers and wipes to families across the state. Once more, I want to say thank you to Mr. Chair for your dedication and hard work and time to be here to hear our testimonies so that we can help our families across the state and for our future generations. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thanks for being with us, and thanks for your important work that you do outside the committee, too. Thank you. Is there any member of the public who wishes to testify on the bill? Not seeing any, so I'll see member questions or discussion, what there is. We'll go to you first. Representative Hudson.
She called it.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got to say, Representative Hicks, I suspect that your eligibility requirements may have been modeled after Diaper Bank of Minnesota, and I'm not even upset about it. It's I actually respect it because, as you stated, you're making an effort to try to get away from this naming of specific recipients, so I appreciate that. I also appreciate in line 119 and 120 demonstrating commitment to work with organizations across ideological and political spectrums. That, of course, should have nothing to do with whether or not we're helping babies have diapers. So I very much appreciate that. My one question is, in lines 117 and 118, the ability to advocate for diaper need at local, state, and federal levels, what does that mean? Are we talking about having a lobbying arm?
No.
Okay. Representative Hicks.
Sorry, Chair. No.
Big diaper, I think, is the...
It is very late. Can we just talk about how late night committees get weird? Okay. This is about making sure that whatever organization is doing this is facilitating this for the whole state and is advocating for the overall needs.
right? Because if we don't have an organization that can come back here and testify and have conversations with us and gather local support to fill in the gaps that this bill is going to leave, right, because it's not going to fully fund, then we're not going to get diapers on the tushies of all the kiddos. So we need an organization that can do that, that can build relationships, that can have those conversations, and can do that strongly so we can make sure we can meet the entire need.
Representative Hudson.
Fair enough. I appreciate the answer.
Okay. Vice Chair Keeler.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. I love diapers. You know that we've talked about it in the as somebody who was a licensed MIFBA mom for a really long time, we would get babies that were removed from their home with really awful sores. And a lot of it had to go back to the hygiene options that they had. Diapers aren't covered in a lot of the state supports. And when we worked on the food shelf bill, we were really clear in the statute there that it wasn't just food that could be provided in those spaces. But again, emergency food shelves are giving out a day or two worth of diapers, and we obviously need more than that. And so I really appreciate this, and I just want to call out that this is an act of family preservation. It's things like this when we invest in the communities to offset the needs that they have. It really, in the long run, helps our families stay together. I know that that's a really weird connection, right, to diapers, but it's also a thing that is stolen a lot because it's just something that young parents need. And so I appreciate you doing this. I appreciate the work that all of you keep doing. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Other member questions or comments? I'll maybe just note, slightly building on Vice Chair Keeler's point, that I guess I view this as being part of, and I would love to, in fact, think about how to expand this, as being part of hopefully a consensus around saying that anybody who has a baby in this state, we're going to take really, really good care of you, in light of some debates that we've had about reproductive rights and other issues, to at least say that I would hope there'd be great consensus everyone around the table that we're going to take very good care of folks, of everybody in our state, and then certainly people who have little kids who need diapers. And so this is a really exciting piece that I guess makes me think about other ways in which we can provide support for pregnant people and for people who are who have young kids. And so I really appreciate the work on this and want to explore how we can do that. Representative Hicks, you get the last word on your bill.
Thank you so much, Chair and Committee, and thank you for the thoughtful discussion. I really, really do appreciate it. I agree with Representative Keeler. I think when people's basic needs are met, we are more likely to keep families together, and that's good for our community. And I also think diapers are really, really expensive. And when you have to travel and use gas to get somewhere and spend $40 on a box of diapers or $40 on groceries, that is a really hard decision for people to make. And so I am excited that everyone heard the bill today and is supportive of the bill, and I am hopeful that we can move this forward in our larger package. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Thanks for all your work, and then the folks from the Diaper Bank. This just could not be more important work. I really appreciate it. Thank you. So with that, members, the chair lays over House file, and make sure I have that bill number correct. Where did that go? Thank you. 2665. As amended for possible inclusion in our budget bill. Thank you so much. Representative Coulter, why don't you head back on up? And members, I feel like we should just do this way. We're going to have the pages, if you could please distribute the fiscal note. I think we'll take just a minute on this. This is House File 993. We had it up before. And Representative Coulter moves House File 993 to bring it back before the committee. And there may not be too much to discuss on it, but I kind of feel like we might as well, since we're together and we have the document, just to kind of do it upright. And so we're having that distributed. And thank you. And as it's being distributed to folks, I'll just see if there are questions anybody has regarding the bill or the fiscal note before I lay it over yet again. Have that at all? Representative Lee.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. While folks are getting the hard copy, I peeked online because the fiscal note was available under the bill profile, and wanted to just maybe get an answer from maybe nonpartisan staff on why the cost goes up and then it goes down in the fiscal note.
Ms. Beckel, if you have a sense as to that? And perhaps if you need a clarification, Representative Lee, pardon me, is what she's asking about. Ms. Bechtel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Solveig Bechtel, House Fiscal. So when we're looking at any programs that go through the Minnesota Department of Education, typically the first year you will only see 90% of the cost because programs through MDE are shifted. That is, in the first year they receive 90%, and then the next year they receive 10% of the previous year's cleanup payment. That means that when you just start a program, there is no 10% prior year cleanup payment. So we're only seeing 90% of the total cost. So that's why you're seeing a lower cost. And you can see that on the smaller chart on page 3. Mm-hmm. In terms of why the cost is slightly higher in fiscal year 25 than in 26 and 27, this is generally related to the number of students that will be screened, and MDE is tracking declining enrollment. So that's just the number of students that would be screened.
Representative Lee, did that answer you? Yeah?
It does. Thank you.
Okay. Members, any other questions or discussion regarding HF 993? I am not seeing any, but I'm glad that we have the fiscal note. Representative Coulter, we'll give you again a chance for any kind of final word you want. I think you probably had it before, but anything?
Mr. Chair, I'm a man of few words.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good call at 8:15. So with that, the chair lays over House File 993 for possible inclusion in a budget bill. And members, I'm going to go up to the testifier table, have Vice Chair Keeler take over, and we're just going to do a little bit of business. And Madam Chair, I will have a motion when you're ready.
Go ahead, Chair Pinto.
Thank you. The motion is to move House File 2293 to the General Register, and I'll maybe just explain the motion, saying that the bills, we're about to move three bills that are vehicle bills that are intended to provide some flexibility as the session moves on. This is a pretty standard thing to do for those who are first in their first terms and new here. We're actually not going to move House File 2292. There's a lot that Ms. Colbert and I are kind of juggling as we've got the MDE side of our work and the DHS side of our work and trying to match up with the Senate and those sides, and happy to explain more. But for now, Madam Chair, the motion is to move House File 2293 to the General Register.
Okay. Any member discussion? Okay. I'm sorry.
Okay. No, all good.
Too late. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Seeing none, House File 2293 is moving to the General Registry.
And then I have two more motions, Madam Chair.
Okay.
I move House File 2698 to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. So we'll do that one next.
Any member discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Hearing none, the House File 2698 moves to Ways and Means.
And then, Madam Chair, the final motion is House File 2476, move to be placed on the General Register.
Any member discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Hearing none, House File 2476 is moved to the General Registry.
And then finally, Madam Chair, if I may, just a preview for folks. On Thursday, we'll be hearing the governor's budget bills in our area. It's two different bills, so one for DHS, one for MDE and children and families. That'll take up the bulk of the whole session on Thursday. A reminder that we received a presentation on those bills in late January, so there's a PowerPoint presentation. We'll have that available, but we're really going to just dive into the actual details of the bills and bill language. And so that's all I have, Madam Chair.
With that, we'll see you tomorrow morning. The committee is now adjourned.